Carlo, Mr. Stringer, and today is not the formal introduction of the bill to the committee. We hope to do that on Friday, when the department has had the opportunity to go through the proper company's bill. The one that we have is a printed copy, printed proof. So once we have the correct certified one, then we'll continue with our work. But what we think to do today is to start into the work. So this is what we'll be doing here, and then pick up the work and the official thing as we move forward. And I hope to do that by Friday when we've got the copy certified copy of the book. So, good folks from the department, we are in your able hands. When you are ready, you may comment.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, all our members, and the members of the public. Today, I have a team here that will assist also with the delivery of the presentation. I will cover the first part of the presentation of today, and Mr. Mongalo will then cover the remaining section. And the team will then further then assist in taking questions and responding to the questions if it's okay with the chair.
That's fine.
Thank you. The purpose of this presentation today really is to give a broad overview of the company's deal, but also with more emphasis on some of the areas that we think may be relevant for this committee since the last time we made the presentation here. So we're not going to go into like each and every section or each and every chapter in detail, but we'll point out some of the areas that we think are significant, at least for this committee to consider. And we would also just highlight some of the main recommendations that have come up, which we have incorporated during the consultation process. You'll recall that Cabinet approved the ratification of this draft company bill. And following that, what we did was to conduct meetings, workshops, and discussions, and sort of conferences across the country to elicit comments from the public. The public draft generated about 134 written submissions, which were very comprehensive and covered a large part of the draft. And what we then did was to still follow up as well with some of the specific stakeholders to ensure that we get clarity on some of the concerns and as well as to ensure that we address some of the concerns that we felt needed to be addressed through discussions as opposed to incorporating in the bill itself. And in general, the public supported the objectives and principles that were entrenched in the draft bill. And although they mentioned a number of areas which they felt could be improved or revised to ensure that at least the bill achieves what needs to be achieved. I think we're all well aware that obviously, you know, moving from the policy document into legislation is always a difficult process, and sometimes you don't achieve what you intended through the drafting, and so we've received comments in that area to at least assist us to achieve what we thought the policy objectives were. This is really the outline of how the bill is structured. You see that the first chapter really deals with the doctrine of substantial compliance, the types of companies, which really relates to the categorization of companies, which we think is important for this committee. Incorporation and registration, company names, corporate finance, corporate governance, all of those issues are dealt with in chapter 2. And chapter 2 and 3, therefore, then deals with transparency and accountability. That's the area, again, where we think that the committee needs to be appraised. And we've got then chapter 4, dealing with public security offerings, and chapter 5, dealing with fundamental transactions. And I think there's a change there that we also obviously want that we will bring to the attention of the committee following the public comments. And the other important area is the business rescue provision in chapter 6. The enforcement mechanisms are catered for in chapter 7 and 9. And the institution mechanisms and the agency issues are dealt with in chapter 8. There you see that the number of agencies that will come obviously into existence, and we'll outline the functions of each of those entities. And then there's then finally the functions of the commission that's going to be established. And I think also that's going to be important because the linkages and the synergies that are required in the functions of the commission in relation to the functions of the other committees that will be established in terms of this field is very important, area that is important for us. And lastly, really, we're dealing with the transitional arrangement. And you know that in the transitional arrangement, what we are dealing with as well there is the relationship between this bill, once it's passed into an act, and the Growth Corporations Act. How is that going to work together going forward? I'll start then, you know, going with the presentation. What we've attempted to do is to go chapter by chapter, to just give an overview of what this chapter covers without necessarily going into detail, as I mentioned earlier. But chapter one, I think the first area that we're dealing with today is issues of interpretation and application, which we think are important. And the important aspect in relation to that is really what the purpose of this bill is, especially in this particular area. I mean, it encompasses that, and it should be seen also in the provisions that are in there. I think the main aim is really to reduce the formality and to improve flexibility. We would like to ensure that the system of regulating companies allows for more flexibility. We accept that there have been attempts that have been made through our systems, improved technology in CIPRO, to ensure that the turnaround times and registration of companies is improved as well. But we think legislatively there's a need to incorporate that flexibility and to acknowledge the ongoing technological development and to also reduce the burden of requirements on the part of companies. So what we then seek to do there, I think Section 6 really speaks to that. It provides for the granting of exemptions for specific companies in respect of certain requirements that exist in the Act. So what it means is that there would be provisions of general application, but then companies that necessarily should not be complying with that could ask for an exemption. And the exemption process, as Trevor will take you through it, should then allow for that flexibility as well, and that it's quick to get such an exemption, and that the companies would not, you know, be delayed in implementing whatever they want to implement based on the fact that they can't get exemptions. So I think the flexibility comes into that not all companies should be required to comply with things that necessarily, by their nature, they should not be complying with. And what we're also putting into place as well is recognition of electronic documents to be used in place of originals. I think we know that this is a difficult area, generally in law, in terms of you know, to what extent you recognize electronic documents and stuff like that. But we think that this bill will address those issues. But in relation to really the use of those documents, we think that electronic documents should at least be should have the same way, you know, expressed then, you know, unless there's an area where original is required. And also what we then dealt with is the electronic publication of documents and electronic delivery of notices. So that's another area again that obviously is established practice in law, that it says how documents should be delivered and all of that. But we're thinking that for the processes of registration and all of that information companies, there needs to be recognition of the electronic document system, but with obviously the necessary safeguards to ensure that we still remain legally compliant with some of the basic requirements that exist in common law. The second aspect really enhances compliance and prevents avoidance. That's still in chapter 6. We've got general anti-avoidance remedies, which would then allow a scheme to be declared void if it seeks to evade a requirement of this particular bill. So if there's a prohibition and there's an attempt to evade it, we have provisions that would deal with that. I think that's an area that's important as well, because I think it gives in fact the proactive power to the regulator to initiate some of those audits and ensure that it monitors and is able to identify such instances and deal with them. And the other thing that we also emphasize under this one in a way of creating clarity and certainty around companies is the use of plain language in documents such as prospectuses and other notices. So we really encourage that, and we decided to emphasize it again further. You know, but like I said, you know, some of these things are not necessarily a substantial move from what we already have, but it is an improvement on some of the areas. Companies incorporated in the Republic would be classified in terms of non-profit companies as well as profit companies. And under non-profit companies, really the important thing to note is that these companies must have at least one public benefit or social or cultural object as part of their purpose. And it must apply all assets to its stated objectives, and the residual value must be distributed to like organizations. And that company, a non-profit company, may not merge or convert into a company. So it cannot merge with a profit company, and it also cannot convert into a profit company. I think those are the things that would then, you know, define really for us what a non-profit company is. And profit companies really speak to public companies that we know them currently, state-owned enterprises, personal liability companies, as well as private companies. And you know that we have consciously added the state-owned companies in an explicit way to make sure that also there's provisions that are explicit in terms of how they would be treated in terms under this company regime. And what we also deal with in this chapter is relating to companies that are incorporated outside the Republic. Those relate to foreign companies and external companies. Just before I move on to that, I think this slide actually is one of the slides which contains some of the changes that came with the public consultation process. You recall that initially we had categorized companies and in relation to widely held companies and closely held. And through the public consultation, obviously, there were sentiments that say, don't introduce new terminology. Let's rather deal with the issues that are problematic with the classification and categorization as opposed to changing the terminology. So there was that sentiment that let's use terms that are common, terms that are understandable to the market, and we think that was something that we were prepared to take up, because we also had that sentiment. Otherwise, we don't want to create more confusion in the market as we try to clarify the process. Further, we deal there still in chapter 2 with the issues of company registration. I think what's important there is really the fact that incorporation of a company is a right. So that's a right that every company has. So because it's a right, we see the need that we must make the process very, very simplistic and very accommodating for companies, such that if that right is given the credence and the weight that it deserves. The policy objective really being to maximize freedom of association and freedom to contract. And one or more persons may incorporate a profit company. So that's the standard basically in terms of the number of people that could incorporate a profit company. And in relation to not-for-profit companies, what we have is three or more persons could then incorporate such a company. And incorporation would continue to happen through the signing of memorandum of incorporation and the filing of a notice of incorporation with the appropriate fee. The memorandum may be pro forma or bespoke, but the form does not suggest or impose any provision. The memorandum of a profit company must set out a number of authorized shares and rights, terms, etc. So this chapter basically then gives a guideline in terms of what is it that should be contained in the memorandum. But what we're pointing out here is some of the key things that should appear as a matter of course. And finally, the memorandum may be in schedule one form, which provides simple checkbox approach. What we've done is an attempt to simplify the process. Obviously, we took an approach that this could be done in a tick box form for companies, such that we don't require companies to write huge motivations. But then when they tick on appropriate factors that we need to consider, then we are able to analyze based on that, as opposed to making them go through the whole process and therefore requiring a lot of assistance either from legal practitioners at all times. But what we think is that it should be a process that is very simple because it's very incorporation, which we consider to be a right. And if we make it complex, then we compromise that part, and I think it would then move to be more of a privilege than a right. Continuing on to the issue of registration, again, the bill contemplates the future internet-based completion and filing of notices and also the memorandum of incorporation. So what we are allowing for, like I said, is to be futuristic in our approach to allow for what we've already seen that is happening in the market. There's a whole lot of development. And I think it's in recognition of the fact that with that development, it's actually talking to the improved turnaround time for the consumer at the end of the day, the companies involved. And all companies that are incorporated, they must file the memorandum of incorporation. So it relates to all of these companies, will be a requirement that they must file a memorandum of incorporation. The notice of incorporation may be rejected only if incomplete or if it names too few directors or initial directors are disqualified. I think this is important for the companies in the sense that when they choose to register, I mean they should not be sent back just on a small technicality, but rather the form must be such that it's incomplete for the regulator to be in a position to register them appropriately. But even with that, obviously we would have interventions that we assist them then to be in a position to complete this form properly, so such that we don't even get too much prevalence on incomplete filings that come to us. The commission would have authority to judge the merits of the company structure, and the commission must also register the company even if the chosen name is unavailable. I think if we all understand the process currently, the issue of name reservations and stuff like that. Sometimes when you want to register, the name is not available, and therefore you cannot register. But what we're saying now is that if the name is not available, you can register the company and issue the registration number and all of that, while then the issue of the name can be sorted out in there. So it should not be a hurdle for the company, purely because the name is unavailable. So we're introducing that kind of flexibility. All companies have compatible legal powers unless restricted by this memorandum of incorporation. Company exists continuously as a juristic person until deregistered, I think that confirms the fact that we're saying they're right. So we cannot just by virtue of us just wanting to register companies and we do that. But I think we've always done that in a sense that the process is always allowed for companies to come back and deregister when they do not want to continue to do more business. Pre-incorporation contracts by companies are binding unless rejected and are deemed to have been ratified 3 months after incorporation unless rejected before that. I think what we're talking about here obviously is before companies are incorporated, there's sometimes negotiations between the directors and maybe even suppliers. And the certain contracts that are concluded in anticipation of the incorporation of the company. So what this talks to is that those types of agreements would then be recognized as binding on the company upon incorporation, unless the company specifically excludes those contracts. The last aspect under this slide is really an issue of reckless trading or trading while insolvent. This is an offense, and we just basically make sure that clear from this provision. The requirements requirements in relation to names of companies, I think the policy to allow freedom of expression. There's obviously, guidelines around them. There would be guidelines that would say, in as much as you've got freedom to express and you can choose any name, there would be limitations in the kinds of name, obviously, that may be used. And the limitations would come, maybe even from the constitutional aspect where, your freedom of expression could be limited. So if the names are offensive and stuff like that, obviously they cannot be accepted. But then I think the policy is here, the policy objective is to achieve that freedom of expression for people in deciding on names. No limits except to prevent fraud and misrepresentation and to avoid use of hate speech and similar offensive names. I think that's kind of already covered. Company name may be the registration number. Also, company name may include numbers or symbols as well as words. Company name must end with designation abbreviation. So this really just speaks to that. Now, these are basically your guidelines in relation to the names that you can use in the company. And there's a process also for name reservation, but that process is optional. Reservation would be for 6 months and may be extended. Reservation is transferable in terms of this deal, and provisions included to address cases of name squatting and trading have also been incorporated in it. We come to the area of the use of names. I think here again the policy really is to abide mm-hmm. the formalities that as we said before, but also to prevent issues of misrepresentation and fraud. The company is free to use its name as and when it sees fit. I think we don't want to regulate that unnecessarily. As long as the name is what approved and is proper, I think the company should be able to use it as and when it is necessary. And a name and registration number must be provided accurately on the request. And it would be an offense not to provide that information in that accurate form. It would also be an offense to misrepresent by use of the company name. But further, it would be an offense for a company to pass off as a company when it actually isn't a company. Office and records. A company must maintain a registered office in the Republic. That is not new. And a company must keep records at its registered office or another disclosed location. Records must be kept for 7 years in written form or at least accessible for printing. Shareholders have a right of access to listed records. So this really speaks to the issue of document management and document retention, and it also gives a guidance in terms of how long the company should keep that. I think this is an area that sometimes we take for granted, but it's important because the issue of keeping documents has a cost implication. And how long you keep that has a cost implication for the company. So it's always important to to give service money, but also to just balance the issue of cost for companies as well. Because we're trying to create and reduce the burden, which the burden on companies here, so we don't want to continue burdening them with necessary requirements. But the issue of document retention is absolutely important, and also reduce the risk on the part of companies. We come to the area of transparency here. I think that's also one important area, and in terms of how you encourage transparency is key, because you don't want to then put lots of burdensome processes to try to get transparency, but you want people to internalize transparency, companies to internalize it, and to take it as something that actually is beneficial to them. But you just want to legislate it to just make sure that at least the minimum requirements for transparency are being met. Accounting records and statements. All companies must maintain accurate accounting records. It is an offense to falsify or fail to keep proper records. All companies must have a financial year. They must still state what the financial year would be. All financial statements given to another person must bear a disclosure statement. And this obviously speaks to that they must state whether these statements are audited or unaudited or they've been reviewed. So that disclosure would be required. It would be an offense to publish false financial statements. I think that's also something that is in the current regime. And all public and most private companies must produce annual financial statements. So that is also a requirement to get disclosure. The issue of annual return also is important when we speak about disclosure. So all companies must file an annual return, and an annual return must include annual financial statements unless the company is exempted from that. The commission may deliver notice requiring an exempt company to produce annual financial statements in future years. That will depend on really what the requirement relates to, but then the commission will have the power to do that. Public companies are subject to additional transparency requirements, which are outlined in Chapter 3. So what we mean there is really that as public companies, there may be more, I think, enhanced transparency requirements, just by virtue of the nature of the public company. And that the impact, if anything happens in that company, may be very, very big, because it has some public interest and it caters for a whole lot of areas which may impact on the economy as well. The next part really speaks to the issue of corporate finance. In this area, the board of directors may increase or decrease the number of authorized shares, in relation to classification. They may basically just they have power to decide on this area in relation to classification, because we know that companies will have like certain classes of shares. So the board of directors is the one that has got the power to look into that. But the second really aspect that is important is the issue of the fact that the board may finance the company through debt. So it's important for us to know there that this approach really is intended to enable the company to compete for capital more effectively in world markets with companies whose boards already have the power to finance their businesses quickly and efficiently. I think this speaks to the area of financing for companies. I mean, the board should be, obviously with the necessary safeguards, like you said, with the necessary safeguards that are incorporated in the legislation, the board should be in a position to make decisions in relation to financing the debt of the company, or to finance the company through debt. Because in other jurisdictions, they allow the board to do that, and we want our company to be in a position to compete effectively and take quick decisions that would assist with their competitiveness. So that part really gives us flexibility around that area. And consideration has also been given to the elimination of the concept of par value and the related concept of nominal capital. But the banks are exempted from this provision in Section 35. The bill also permits, obviously subject to limitations, the both pro rata and non-pro rata share acquisitions if approved by the board, without requirements that could delay a desirable transaction without providing significant benefits to the company or potential shareholders. Again, that also speaks to what I've been talking about, because sometimes, because of our processes and requirements, we find that companies are unable to take strategic decisions that could assist them. So we recognize the powers of the board to really deal with those kinds of issues, but that we can necessarily test and balance it. It also permits any company to make any distribution upon approval by the board and without shareholder approval, but subject to the existing equity solvency and balance sheet solvency test. So the solvency test and the equity test are always going to be important in all this, because the company needs to always look into that particular status before they can make decisions. So those will be the limitations to some of the powers that are given to the board. Directors would be jointly and severally liable to the company for distribution, which is in excess of what is permitted under the Act. So again, this is a safeguard that is given by the legislation. However, what will be required is proof of violation of the director's standard of conduct before one could really invoke the issue of liability. Consideration has also been given to whether senior liquidation preferences should be treated as liabilities of the company for the purpose of the share repurchases and or any distribution of the shareholders, which will be the case only if provided in the memorandum of incorporation. Okay, here we're talking about the issue of the limitations that may not be necessary. So we're talking about maintaining economically unnecessary limitations on equity in investments in South Africa, in South African companies, would put these companies in a competitive disadvantage with companies formed under the laws of the jurisdiction with more modern and permissive statutes. Like I think I've mentioned this point, and I won't dwell on it. It's really about just making sure and recognizing developments in other jurisdictions which our companies are expected to go through. Consideration was also given to permitting the board to authorize financial assistance for share acquisition, subject again to the solvency limitation. The next aspect is really in relation to corporate governance. I'm not going to go through all of that, but I think the important thing to mention here is that what we thought to do in terms of this year, and we see now that the revised year has been repackaged as well, to take all aspects that relate to corporate governance into one chapter where, you know, directors can just zoom into and say, these are my responsibilities and my obligations. So we've just repackaged that, but there's no significant change. What we have thought to do is to qualify what we think has been really voluntary things. But I think, you know, based on development and practice worldwide, you know, it's recognized that there's a need to qualify these obligations and the duties of directors. And this chapter really deals with that, so that. And we see that it really deals with the issues of the shareholders' rights to be represented, and either personally or personally, and all of that. And the election of directors, how to actually happen. Also, the disqualification of directors is also discussed under that. But importantly, is really also the issue of the liability of directors and prescribed officers. To what extent will they then be liable for any breach that arises from this provision? And then also the issue of indemnification and directors' insurance is also covered under that. I think that chapter will then indicate to us under what circumstances the company will take up insurance, for instance, but it gives them the power to do that, to take up insurance for the directors and all of that. But then there's also just, you know, studies and guidelines in relation to those. The last aspect that I'm going to be dealing with before TEPO takes over is the issue of public security offerings. This chapter really addresses, among others, actions that are not an offer to the public, standards for qualifying employee share schemes, general restrictions on offers to the public, requirements concerning prospectus, secondary offers to the public, and liability and responsibility for untrue statements in prospectus. This is really where companies go out and make offers to the market. So this really talks to certain things that are requirements for the companies to address. All right, and Sepo will take you through that. Sepo can guide us, we can talk about whether we can just proceed with the presentation. But this is where I will stop for now.
I think let us further continue.
Thanks, honorable members. My name is Sepo Mano. I would then continue from chapter 5. Maybe just to start here, I think that it is better to just put in this in context and try to explain what really has changed following the public comments that we received between the publication of the bill in February 2007 to the approval of the revised bill by Cabinet. Now, you will realize that insofar as fundamental transactions are concerned, one of the most important measures or issues relating to fundamental transactions was the required majority for the approval of fundamental transactions. Those are the transactions that speak to the disposal of all or greater part of the assets of the company or the undertaking. And secondly, the mergers or amalgamation for company. And thirdly, schemes of arrangement. Now, previously under the published version of the bill, we were proposing that an ordinary resolution was required for such transactions, but that seems to be out of line with the provisions of the Corporate Laws Amendment Act relating to sale of subsidiary or the assets of the company. And right now, the bill is actually saying that a special resolution is required. But the chapter itself is actually divided into three main parts. Part one, dealing with the approval for certain fundamental transactions, and part B, dealing with the authority of the Takeover Regulation Panel, which will replace the current Securities Regulation Panel, and part C, dealing with the regulation of affected transactions and on offers. Now, the bill recognizes, as I've already said, those three main transactions as fundamental transactions. And therefore, one other point that we need to realize is that those fundamental transactions are actually applicable, the rules relating to the approval are applicable to all companies, and not only applicable to companies that fall within the jurisdiction of the Takeover Regulation Panel, as it seems to be the case under the published draft of the bill, which meant that companies that were not falling under the jurisdiction of the Takeover Regulation Panel could actually be able to have their approval measures that were different from the other companies. Now, we have attempted to regulate all companies in relation to fundamental transactions in the same way, rather than only subject the approval mechanism to only those that fall under the Takeover Regulation Panel. Now we discuss those transactions in turn, starting with the transactions to sell or dispose of all or the greater part of the assets of the company or the undertaking. There are exemptions there, and this section does not apply to a transaction that is pursuant to a business rescue plan adopted in accordance with Chapter 6. I think there are reasons why we would not want the provisions of the section to apply to the business rescue provisions, because the business rescue provisions are a special set of provisions that need to be given protection for the purposes of ensuring that job loss and job losses are minimized, if possible, also avoided. And also the fact that the companies are able to exist is continue in existence and therefore benefit the existing stakeholders as opposed to a situation where the companies would be liquidated. And secondly, between a wholly owned subsidiary and its holding company, or between or among two or more wholly owned subsidiaries of the same holding company, and or a wholly owned subsidiary or a holding company on the one hand, and its holding company, and one or more wholly owned subsidiaries of that holding company on the other hand. The requirements in relation to the disposal or sale of assets of the company for the greater part of the assets of the company are as follows. A company may not dispose of all or greater part of the assets of the undertaking unless the disposal has been approved by a special resolution, as I've already emphasized, and also in accordance with Section 115, dealing with the approval requirements in relation to quorum requirements and all the necessary approvals that need to be observed, particularly if the company is regulated or falls within the jurisdiction of the Takeover Regulation Panel or other legislation actually requires the approval of such transaction. And in relation to the proposal for merger or amalgamation, you will see that one major change here is to basically combine the definitions of a merger and amalgamation, because under the published version of the draft, a merger was defined differently from an amalgamation, where in a merger, basically, there would be, in most cases, no need to form a new company, but there would be a surviving merged company as a result of all the other companies merging into that company. But with regard to an amalgamation where it was envisaging the formation of one or more new companies as a result of the amalgamation agreement. But right now, since there were no different consequences for these two transactions, the comments recommended that we combine the definitions, and that is what has been done. Now, upon implementation of this agreement, a merger or amalgamation, each amalgamation of a merged company has to satisfy the solvency and liquidity test. That is, either the surviving merged company or the newly incorporated company must satisfy the solvency and liquidity test. And this is very important, particularly because the liabilities and assets of all the merging and amalgamating companies will be the liabilities and the assets of the merged or surviving amalgamated company. And as a result, you need to have a situation where such liabilities may be satisfied through the assets that are now within the company that is surviving or is newly incorporated as a result of a merger and amalgamation. And the amalgamating or merging company must enter into an agreement setting out, in particular, one, the proposed memorandum of incorporation of any company to be formed by the amalgamation or merger, and the name and identity number of each proposed director of any proposed amalgamation or merged company, and the manner in which the securities of each amalgamation or merging company are to be converted in securities of any proposed amalgamation or merged company. Here, the fact is, as a result of a merger, it is possible that securities may be converted, and securities meaning shares and any debt securities that previously belonged to holders of securities in amalgamating or merging companies. Now, if those securities are going to be converted into the securities of the newly incorporated company or the surviving merged company, then there must be clear guidelines as to the division of such securities among the security holders, and as to whether people will get one for two shares that they held in the previously merged amalgamation company or previously merging company. We must also think if any of the securities of any amalgamation or merging company are to be converted into securities of any proposed amalgamation or merged company, the consideration that the holders of those securities are to receive in addition to or instead of securities of any proposed amalgamation company. The fact is, under such circumstances, it is possible that you may not be exchanging money for the security that the distributor orders have in line with the agreement. It may be that they need to be paid in cash or in kind, and therefore the particulars relating to such payment or the consideration to be paid must be stated in the agreement, and also the manner of payment of any consideration to be issued as a result of that. Must also state the details of the proposed allocation of the assets and liabilities of the matching or amalgamating company, and also the details of any arrangement or strategy necessary to complete the amalgamation or the merger, and also the estimated cost of the proposed amalgamation or merger, which is quite important. Now, schemes of arrangement are a little bit in line with the schemes of arrangement as we know them under the current Section 311 of the 1973 Companies Act. The only difference that I would like to emphasize is that in relation to the proposed scheme in terms of Section 114, is that the compromise has been divorced from a proper scheme of arrangement. Because as you will be aware, that in terms of Section 311 of the 1973 Act, schemes of arrangement are actually combined with compromises. And what we have realized is that compromises are actually an agreement between creditors of the company and the company itself, while schemes of arrangement relate to agreements between the holders of equity securities, those are shares, together with the company. And therefore, to combine the two didn't make sense. And that's why the scheme of arrangement currently under Section 114 only deals with the arrangement between the shareholders and the company. Compromises are now dealt with as part and parcel of the business rescue mechanism under Part E of Chapter 6, as you will see. Now, the scheme of arrangement is actually an arrangement between the company and any holders of any class of its securities, which will include a reorganization of the share capital of the company by way of, among others, the consolidation of the securities of different classes. For an example, if a company would like to consolidate the preference shares together with ordinary shares, and under such circumstances an agreement may be made as to how that is going to be effected, and that would constitute a scheme of arrangement where there's a proposal for the division of securities into different classes. For an example, if ordinary shares are going to be divided into shares of and preference shares and any other redeemable preference shares, that can also be done through the scheme of arrangement. And it may be done for a variety of reasons. Companies may have a number of reasons why they need to consolidate or divide securities into different classes. And also through an expropriation of securities from the holders. That may be agreed through the scheme of arrangement. And also in extending any of the securities for other securities. And a reacquisition by the company of these securities can actually be done through the scheme of arrangement. And it may also include a combination, if as it does in many cases, a combination of all the methods that are contemplated in this subsection 1 of 114. What are the requirements then in relation to the schemes of arrangement? Given the special nature of the schemes of arrangement, and as you have already realized that the complexity that may be effected as a result of the devising of the scheme of arrangement. The bill proposes that there must be retained for this particular purpose an independent expert who must meet the following requirements. Firstly, that he must be qualified and have the competence and experience necessary to understand the type of arrangement proposed and evaluate the consequences of the arrangement, and also to assess the effect of the arrangement on the value of securities and on the rights and interests of the company. And that particular independent expert must be able to express opinions and exercise judgment and make decisions in such a way. Most importantly, in relation to independence, the person, the expert must not have any other relationship with the company or with a proponent of the arrangement, such as would lead a reasonable and informed third party to conclude that the integrity impartiality or objectivity of the person is compromised by the relationship. In other words, an objective test is used to determine whether that particular person is independent in relation to the activities that he will be undertaking for the purposes of taking this transaction forward. And he must not have had any relationship contemplated in the above third paragraph within the immediately preceding 2 years, or be related to a person who has or has had a relationship contemplated in subparagraph 1 or 2. Now, all this are actually explained as to what constitutes a related or interrelated person as part and parcel of interpretation and application in chapter 1. What does the expert have to do? This expert must prepare a report to the board concerning the proposed arrangement, which must at least or at a minimum contain the following. It must take all the prescribed information relevant to the value of the securities affected by the proposed arrangement and identify every type and class of holder of the company securities affected by the proposed arrangement and describe the material effects that the proposed arrangement will have on the rights and interests of the persons mentioned in paragraph 1, and evaluate any material adverse effects on the proposed arrangement. And the report must also include a copy of section 115 in relation to the required approval for transactions and 164 relation to appraisal rights. Now, the appraisal rights, which we will deal with at a later stage, are the rights that are given to the security holders, the shareholders, who have voted against the approval of a fundamental transaction. And as a result, the fundamental transaction nevertheless went ahead because it had the required majority. For example, it did require a special resolution. The special resolution is passed. But a person says, I don't see this to be a very good transaction for the company. Basically, ultimately, it's going to bring the company to its knees. And I am objecting to this fundamental transaction, which could be a merger or amalgamation, which could be a scheme of arrangement, which could also be a disposal of assets or greater part of the assets or undertaking of the company. If that person says that I object to that particular transaction and I'm giving you notice that I will be objecting to it and I will be exercising my right to have my shares bought by the company at a fair price, if this transaction goes ahead, that particular person will be entitled to appraisal rights in terms of section 164. Now, insofar as the implementation of the merger amalgamation is concerned, each of the merging or amalgamation company must give notice to every known creditor of that company. And a creditor may seek leave to apply to a court for a review of the merger or amalgamation only on the grounds that the creditor will be materially prejudiced by the amalgamation or merger. And a court may only grant the leave if satisfied of those 3 points. And one thing that I want us to remember is that this creditor remedy does not apply to a company engaged in business rescue proceedings pursuant to the company's business rescue plan adopted in accordance with Chapter 6. And I think there are valid reasons why you would not want to subject a business rescue plan to an objection by the creditor. Otherwise, then every creditor who fails that, you know, he has been outvoted in a business rescue plan would come and want to enforce this particular remedy, and no business rescue plan would ever see the light of day. And that is why this remedy is not available for a creditor when there is a business rescue plan proposed or adopted in line with Chapter 6. Now, a notice of amalgamation or merger must include confirmation that the amalgamation or merger has satisfied the requirements of Section 113 and Section 115. These are in relation to the fact that the amalgamation or merger is not part and parcel of the business rescue plan, and that it is complying with the solvency and liquidity test upon the completion of the amalgamation or merger, and that the special resolution has been complied with. and it must have been approved in terms of the Competition Act of 1998, if so required by that act, and must have been granted the consent of the Minister of Finance in terms of Section 54 of the Banks Act, which requires that such amalgamations or mergers between companies which are basically banks must actually get such consent from the Minister of Finance in terms of that act, the Banks Act. And also that the transaction is not subject to further approval by any regulatory authority or any unfulfilled conditions imposed by any, by or in terms of any law. Or that the, and the memorandum of incorporation of any company newly incorporated in terms of the agreement. Now, after receiving a notice of amalgamation or merger, the commission, which will be responsible obviously for administering or regulating issues relating to the newly amalgamated companies or the remaining merged company, is that it must issue a registration certificate for each company newly incorporated in terms of the agreement and deregister each of the amalgamation or merging companies that has not survived the merger. Now, as I've already said, the process in merger and amalgamation is that there will be, in one case, the establishment of a new company, which is going to hold all the assets and the liabilities of all the amalgamation companies. And in other cases, it could be that there will be a remaining matched or amalgamated company out of all the amalgamating companies. If A, B, C, and D companies are merging, but the agreement is that A shall survive the merger or the amalgamation, then all the assets of B, C, and D will then become the assets of A. And all the liabilities of B, C, and D will become the liabilities of A. And as a result, such a remaining company or newly incorporated company must satisfy all the requirements that are required in terms of this act. And it must be, if it is a newly incorporated company, there must be a registration certificate which is issued. And those that are not surviving that particular transaction must then be deregistered and be removed from the register of the commission. And when a merger or amalgamation agreement has been implemented, the properties of all registered of all those amalgamation or missing companies then become the properties of the surviving or newly incorporated company. And also the obligations as well. Now, insofar as the authority of the Takeover Regulation Panel is concerned, we need to bear in mind that the Takeover Regulation Panel does not have jurisdiction to regulate the transactions of all companies. It only has the jurisdiction to regulate the transactions of companies if those transactions constitute an affected transaction. And an affected transaction is a transaction that would actually be undertaken by a regulated company. And a regulated company means a public company or a private company if it is, it has got actively traded securities. And under such circumstances, then such companies fall within the jurisdiction of the Takeover Regulation Panel. Now, in definition of an affected company, you will see that the bill is actually including all the affected transactions, but only insofar as they relate to regulated companies. All fundamental transactions only insofar as they relate to regulated companies. That means your merger or amalgamation, your disposal or sale of all the assets of the company or greater part of the assets of the undertaking, and the schemes of arrangement are only affected transactions if a regulated company is involved. And this means a company under the jurisdiction of the Takeover Regulation Panel. And in addition to that, you've got other transactions which are in line with international legislation, which are the acquisition of a substantial proportion of the securities of the company in the multiples of five. And under such circumstances, the intention would be that the person who acquires such an enormous or substantial amount of securities, the intention is that they will ultimately want to take over that particular company or reach a particular strategic point where they will then be able to exercise mandatory requirements. And under such circumstances, you have to disclose. And therefore, that falls within the jurisdiction of the Takeover Regulation Panel if the company, obviously, is a regulated company. And also the mandatory offer, compulsory acquisition. Now, a mandatory offer really is a transaction which, or it's an offer which, when reached, or a percentage which, when reached by the offeror of the securities of the company, that offeror must then be able to issue a notice to the remaining holders of the securities that he would like to acquire their securities. And it is set now at a minimum of 35%. Each time a person acquires 35% of the shares of a particular type in a company, that particular person would then be under an obligation to offer a notice to the remaining shareholders that he is prepared to acquire their shares at a price, at a fair price, that is determined in accordance with the takeover regulations, and it is obviously in line with the offer that has been accepted by the securities of the have been acquired, or which have been acquired at the time when he received 35% or more. And at that point, then the offerer will then be obliged to issue such a notice. But the difference is that in a mandatory offer, as opposed to a squeeze-out transaction, is that the offeror is not under an obligation to acquire all of the securities, and the people who are given the notice are not under an obligation to offer those securities to the offeror. But in a squeeze-out, where an offeror has reached 90% of the securities of a particular class in that particular company, then he is obliged to actually then pay out whatever a fair price that it has been determined in line with takeover regulations to the remaining 10% of the security holders. And that is in order to protect the minority shareholders in the first place, and also to ensure that a majority shareholder is not ultimately or unduly oppressed by the minorities within the company. And the squeeze-out provision is now reenactment of what is currently Section 440K of the current Companies Act of 1977. Now, the role really of the takeover regulation panel is to ensure the integrity of the marketplace and fairness to the holders of the securities of regulated companies, and to ensure that the provision of necessary information to holders of securities of a regulated company, to the extent that is required to facilitate the making of a fair and informed decision by the security holders, and to provide also adequate time for regulated companies and holders of their securities to obtain and provide advice with respect to offers, and to prevent actions by a regulated company designed to impede, frustrate, or defeat an offer, or the making of a fair and informed decision by the holders of the company's securities. Now, in many other jurisdictions where they've got very liberal takeover models, they allow the actions by the company which is concerned with this affected transaction to basically be able to oppose, even though in some instances may be very unreasonably, because it may be to prejudice the interest of the shareholders. In our jurisdiction, we're saying that a company will be impeded from frustrating a beneficial action or a beneficial transaction for the security holder where it is seen that it is in the interest of the security.
Sorry. Could you could Mongolo just perhaps just slightly clarify securities? You know, if we look in the book, it says securities are as defined in the Securities Act. I'm not 100% sure that what I understand and what you're talking about, you know, when you use the word securities, if you don't mind.
Okay. Yeah, securities are really, if you look into the Securities Services Act, they include shares and debt instruments like debentures. Those are basically your securities. And in a number of instances, when the reference is made to securities, it's really shares. And that term is used, for an example, to try to avoid a confusion between debt securities and shares. And it may include debt securities and sometimes it may only be shared. But where we say of a particular class and we refer to equity securities, those are only shares. But if we refer to debt instruments, those are debt securities. That means your debentures. And a simplistic definition would be that a share obviously entitles a holder to the right to vote, the right to attend meetings, the right to be able to affect whatever transaction or to influence whatever transaction that affects the holder of that security. But in relation to a debt security, the holder basically is in the position of a lender to the company. Exactly. The company owes you something, although it is defined as a security because it's an investment over a long term. But ultimately, that investment has to be paid back to you. With a share, the investment doesn't have to be paid back to you. You may, of course, acquire it through the dividends that are paid by the company on an ongoing basis and be able to accumulate whatever the investment you made in that company. But the fact is, if the company goes bust, if the money that is left, the residual value of the company, is only sufficient to pay the creditors, you as a shareholder cannot come to the company and say, I was an investor, and therefore I need my money back. That is a different kind of security, as opposed to a debt security. In a debt security, I am counted as one of the creditors when the company goes bust.
Thank you. Okay.
I've already explained the compulsory acquisition. I don't want to go too deep into detail on that, except just to say that the time frames are very important and they are aligned with many statutes and corporate legislation that we looked at with which South Africa share company law traditions, and they are in fact aligned to the provisions of Section 440K of the current 1973 Act. Now, I am made to understand that the honorable members received the draft presentation that we prepared about a week ago, which was actually the summary of the amendments to the bill as it was, or the changes to the bill as it was approved by Cabinet in 2007. And those and that draft presentation basically explains chapter 6. I do not want just to go to chapter 8 without having emphasized what the provisions of chapter 6 are in relation to business rescue. Now, one thing that I must emphasize is that business rescue is to a large extent, or the provisions of business rescue, chapter 6, are to a large extent unchanged from the 2007 version as approved by the by Cabinet. Although I need to emphasize a few points. Firstly, that due to additional consultations that we had as a department with relevant stakeholders, particularly the business and labor, through the NEDLAC consultations, the chapter has now been amended to be aligned with the provisions of Labor Relations Act to start with. Now, what the problem that we have identified was that, and which labor was very much concerned about, is that in a business rescue plan, I mean, when a business has been rescued, there must be a business rescue plan. Now, in a business rescue plan, the approval mechanisms for a business rescue plan may actually include retrenchment of employees. And now, if you look at approval requirements there, the creditors, which may include also the employees to the extent of any unpaid remuneration, is required. That means that the creditors must approve the business rescue plan. But if you look at the Labor Relations Act, Section 197, if I'm not mistaken, says that at the time when there is a contemplation of the retrenchment, then the controllers of the company need to engage into consultation processes with the registered trade union for the purposes of finding any mechanisms that may avert that particular retrenchment or even reduce the, its potency. And the issue that was raised by Labor and NEDLAC was whether if a business rescue plan contemplates the retrenchment, does it mean that the provisions of Section 197 don't have to be complied with? We have to go back. We have to go back to the drawing board and try to align the provisions of Chapter 6 with the provisions of the Labor Relations Act in relation to consultation. That in addition to being required to be approved by the creditors of the company, the business rescue plan which contemplates retrenchment has to be done in line, obviously, with the provisions of the Labor Relations Act. And also what we would realize in relation to business rescue that is quite different from the published version of the bill is that the compromises which were previously under the 1973 part and parcel of the schemes of arrangement under Section 311 are now made a specific part in the business rescue under Part E and to a large extent unaltered because there's a lot of case law dealing with compromises. That is the arrangement between the creditors and the company in order to avert the liquidation of the company. And to an extent that such compromises have been beneficial in the South African environment for saving companies, we found that it would be a serious mistake on our part to leave it out when we regulate schemes of arrangement insofar as they relate to shareholders and the company. And having said that, I just needed to emphasize those two main important issues. But other than that, I don't think that we need to emphasize any other issues in relation to Chapter 6. Now, Chapter 7 is to a large extent unchanged and it relates to the enforcement of the provisions of the bill through inspections, through investigations by inspectors and investigators, particularly with those who will be residing within the commission and sometimes even outside inspectors and investors who may be appointed for the purposes of inspection. Then the nitty-gritty of the enforcement is basically found in Chapter 7 and also in Chapter 8 relating to the structures of the regulatory agencies that are responsible for enforcement of the Act. And you will see that one of the most important regulatory agencies is the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, which is going to be an amalgamation, obviously, of the enforcement functions currently within the DTI, together with the registration functions currently residing within the Companies and Intellectual Property Registration Office to form the Companies and Intellectual Properties Commission. Now, what will this commission do? In brief, it will actually maintain and operate the registry of close corporation, the registry of cooperatives, the registry of companies, and registries of intellectual property rights, and also to monitor and promote compliance with the Act. And to a large extent through compliance notices or compliance orders. Now, since we have moved from the enforcement mechanism based on criminal sanctions to a more effective mechanism based on compliance orders, we realized that it would be important if this power resided within the commission and that could actually be effectively and easily dealt with since it's an administrative penalty rather than a criminal penalty, which would require the criminal justice system to be brought into operation. And how does it enforce this act? The commission enforces the act by receiving and investigating complaints, issuing compliance orders, and referring offenses for prosecution. In cases where there's a criminal penalty that is envisaged, it would have to be referred to the relevant prosecution authorities for the purposes of prosecution. But the groundwork would have to be done within the commission itself. And then the investigations, the inspections, and all the other powers that are granted to the commission would have to be done. By the time that it goes to the prosecution authorities for prosecution, it is almost at a completed state. Unlike where you just file a complaint with the prosecution authorities and find that in many cases, such criminal penalties would never see the light of day, would never be enforced because there was no groundwork that was proposed in terms of the previous legislation to be done within a regulatory agency such as the commission. And also the commission will conduct research, promote education, and coordinate with other agencies and report to the minister. Now, we must remember that the commission is ultimately responsible to or accountable to the minister and reports to the minister, even though it is an autonomous institution responsible for effect, for enforcing the provisions of the Act. Now, the Takeover Regulation Panel, to a large extent, replaces the current Securities Regulation Panel, which are reduced number of panel members, and it regulates affected transactions and offers and advises the Minister on takeover regulations. Now, you must remember that many of the transactions that were previously regulated under the Securities Regulation Panel jurisdiction were basically found under the Takeover Code, which was a private sector document which did not have the legal backing the legal backing as the regulations are going to be after enactment of this legislation. Many of those transactions are now reflected under the Act because we found them to be part and parcel of the corporate structure that needs to be adopted for the purposes of the Act, and those include the mandatory offers, which were not previously under the Act, and I've already explained what those are. And insofar as advising the Minister on takeover regulations, we understand that if you give legal backing to a document, it will actually be in the form of a secondary legislation, particularly the takeover code. Therefore, it is going to become takeover regulations, and as such, since it is a secondary legislation, it cannot be a power that can be exercised by a private body for the purposes of that, because that will be in conflict with the Constitution. And that is why, although the groundwork will be done by the Takeover Regulation Panel, ultimately the Minister authorizes the takeover regulations since they constitute secondary legislation, and in terms of the Constitution, the Executive is responsible for issuing or is responsible for passing secondary legislation. Otherwise, it would have been something that would be unconstitutional or a challenge if it were to be done otherwise. The company's ombud. I see that there's a mistake there. They refer to ombud. It's not in the plural. It's an ombud. It's a company's ombud. It's a body. This body actually adjudicates disputes over the commission's decision and compliance notices, which means that to an extent that there's an administrative order that is issued by the commission, then the right of appeal or review of such administrative decisions lies within the commission, while at the same time the High Court still retain their residual power to be able to adjudicate on these matters. But insofar as administrative matters are concerned, it would be quite easy to offer a body which is not a court such a power to be able to review such administrative decisions. And the company's ombud was seen as appropriate for that purpose. And this body may also serve as an alternative dispute resolution agent, or may also accredit certain institutions as alternative dispute resolution agents between private parties in dispute under the Act, including the companies themselves. And the Financial Reporting Standards Council, to a large extent, will be responsible for receiving reports from the Commission concerning compliance with financial reporting standards, and will advise the Minister on financial reporting standards. As we are aware that with the implementation of the Corporate Laws Amendment Act last year in December, the Financial Reporting Standards Council was constituted. And that particular Financial Reporting Standards Council is responsible for issuing financial reporting standards, which are mainly international financial reporting standards as issued by the IASB, International Association of International Accounting Standards Board, so that our companies will be in compliance with international financial reporting standards, so that we can be able to attract investment and know that our investments are safe. And whenever we see their financial statements, we know that they are correct because they are done in line with international financial reporting standards. That body is responsible for ensuring such compliance, and also advises the minister on the issuance of the financial reporting standards as emanating from the international body responsible for issuing international financial reporting standards. And those standards will obviously be issued by way of regulation. And it is also a secondary legislation for which the minister has got overall responsibility for ensuring that it is ultimately approved and in the public domain. Now, lastly, what I would like us to discuss is the relationship between this Act and the Close Corporations Act. You may be well aware that at the time when I was presenting to you last year on the relationship between the bill and the Close Corporations Act, there was uncertainty as to whether this legislation was going to repeal the Close Corporations Act upon the implementation of the legislation. There was a provision which said that upon the implementation of this legislation, it will actually repeal the Close Corporations Act, but subject to a process which had to be followed by the Minister of Trade and Industry, which was that within 8 years from the implementation of this legislation, the Minister had to write a report to Parliament explaining on the feasibility of the continued coexistence of the two corporate legislative enactments regulating incorporation of corporate entities in South Africa. And if within that time the Minister recommends that the Close Corporations Act must be repealed, then counting from that time, within 2 years, that the legislation was going to repeal the Close Corporations Act. And it also went forward to say that if after 12 years from the implementation of this legislation, nothing would have been done, then the two legislative enactments will continue indefinitely. That was criticized by a number of commentators who said that it brings into equation uncertainty as to what is the relationship now or what is the status of the Close Corporations Act upon the implementation of this legislation. And following the comments that we have received, this provision was revised extensively to say that since this legislation to a large extent is going to be simplified in so much so that it's going to be even simpler than the Close Corporations Act in relation to the incorporation of companies, then there is a need for a coexistence of this legislation and the Close Corporations Act. That means the Close Corporations Act is not going to be automatically repealed by this legislation. It will coexist with this legislation when it becomes effective. But the Close Corporations Act has been amended tremendously to bring it in line with this legislation, so that at least you don't have regulatory arbitrage. And what has happened is that the bill now proposes that the existing closed corporations will be free to retain their current status until they determine that it is in their interest to convert to companies, which it is likely that many will do, and that the Closed Corporations Act will be closed as an avenue for incorporation of new entities or for the conversion of the companies into closed corporations as of the effective date. Basically, what that means is that from the effective date of this legislation, the avenue of registering closed corporations will be closed, and the avenue of incorporating new closed corporations, as of converting companies into closed corporations, will also be closed, trying to avoid regulatory arbitrage. And to a large extent, this has got very beneficial requirements that are not found in the Close Corporations Act. For example, including the issues going to the financial statement, the exemption of the companies from producing annual financial statements, the exemptions of companies from having to have an audit. And currently, the Close Corporations Act, from the incorporation, you have to reserve a name, and you have to have the accounting officer's letter upon incorporation, things which are not a requirement for the purposes of this bill when it becomes effective. And as a result, it would be unthinkable to actually continue to insist on the implementation of the incorporation of the new Close Corporations Act when there's another system which could actually be resorted to without having to comply with such a burdensome regulatory requirement. In conclusion, therefore, I would like to just thank you. That is just a summary of the main recommendations and changes that were effected to the bill as a result of the comments that we have received. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mangano and Ms. Ntuli. You still wanted to say something?
Thank you. I just wanted to really just summarize after all of this, but really from the time on we came to now, there are essentially just, you know, four key areas that have changed. And the first area is really the categorization of the companies, which we've already indicated, that we've moved back to retaining familiar language, and what we then emphasize on is really to ensure that we incorporate the simplification, reduce the burden and all of that, as opposed to changing terminology. And the second aspect is around fundamental transactions, which initially in that particular draft, it suggested that this would be an obligation only for public companies, but this is a requirement for all companies. So this bill just clarifies that further, that's following the comment. And the third area is in relation to rescue provisions, the provisions relating to business rescue. We've emphasized just there that now the test is not the Solvency Act, it's rather the business being in financial distress, because there's a clear distinction in terms of when you get to a situation where you find yourself in an insolvent act, you know, it's already late. So we need to be in a position to detect, you know, the need to rescue a business before it gets to that stage. So that is the change that we've included there to replace the Insolvency Act with financially distressed as a test. And the fourth aspect is really in relation to corporate governance. But like what I said, we didn't change anything there. But there was emphasis that it looks like the responsibilities and duties of directors are spread across the bill, and it's a big document. So we decided to now accommodate them and consolidate them into one chapter where, you know, it could be clear to the directors what their responsibilities and duties are. And then the last aspect was really that is brought about generally, not in relation to the comments now, generally by this bill, is really to balance the criminalization in relation to the administrative penalty. So we realized that there's a lot of things that have been created as offenses and being criminalized, when actually administrative penalties could deal with them faster and provide immediate redress to the people that really are affected by them. So we've then just balanced that. I mean, there are key things, there's certain conduct that is clearly unacceptable and will be criminal. You know, where you falsify documents and all of that would clearly be criminal. But there's certain things that were just criminalized when they could be addressed. So we've then just kept at it. And the last aspect that I need to just also emphasize for the committee is that when we talk about the improvement in the flexibility, we focus really on looking at the functionalities that will then help us improve the system as opposed to the formalities. So we moved the focus from really requiring formalities of forms, is this form, did you take this box or didn't you take, but rather looking at things that will add value to the functioning of the company's law regime. And lastly, it's really when we looked at simplification again, and I know that in various forums where we go, you know, people will say, but you're talking about simplification, but the document, the bill is so huge. Unfortunately, it has to be this huge because it has to accommodate all of the things and cater for all of these things. But we emphasize that the process now that this bill is bringing about must be simplified. You know, when a person moves and go and register a company, the process must be easy for that person to register a company. It must not be a complicated process. So we've moved simplification in relation to our processes. And with the successes that we've already and the improvements that we've seen in our systems in relation to registration of companies at CIPRO, we're certain that this bill will certainly improve on that, and that we will be in a position to deliver this if we are implementing this in a proper manner. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, quite an extensive. Nation. taken a closer view of the bird in front of us. I invite members to make their comments and pose questions. I don't know whether Mr. Bongaro, thank you, and sincerely thank you for your submission. You mentioned in your submission, you mentioned the squeeze out, and you said the mandatory takeover and a hostile takeover. Now, when I got my education at business school, we spoke about hostile takeovers. Is there a legal difference between a hostile takeover, a squeeze out, and a mandatory takeover? Can you explain it in layman's terms?
Should we wait for all the questions?
No, I'd rather wait for the questions. Otherwise, if you have to take them one by one, we will sleep here tonight. And nobody brought blankets. Mera Mujibe, I think there's a problem with the mic, but can you... Marcel, can you get somebody to check what's happening to the mic?
Thank you, Chair. And I wish to thank... the presenter for really that clear presentation, and also I would like to also comment or congratulate them, especially on the first page, you know, in terms of the duty, the purpose of the amendment meant to reduce the formality, because I think that has been a long problem existing in the people that they are supposed to be improving their lives. I just want to find out as to the capacity given the enormous, you know, task that is going to be carried out by this bill. And also on page four, with regards to the name, you know, the name of the registered company, how long does it take? How long does it take before you can respond to the actual name of the company? Now, you spoke also on business rescue. You said you want to detect the company before it becomes insolvent. One would really be interested to know how are we going to do that. And the last chapter two. On page 18, with regards to monitoring and promoting compliance, can you share with us how you are going to be really doing this, the instruments or mechanisms that you use to do this? Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor
Ramji.
My question also relates to some of the questions that some of the family has asked. But maybe before I go to my question, also to congratulate the presentation. I think it was done very well. But two questions, you know, it's so easy to go on with the question here, but implementation. That is, it becomes a problem.
That's why we have to be sure of the capacity. How many people are going to be in this? And how many companies exactly do we have now? Some of the things that we have said, for instance, the problem is before a company can do something, you'll be able to detect that and you'll be able to help companies. Do you have capacity to do that? Maybe there's a new, maybe there'll be a new organism just to do with companies. In fact, if that is done, we'll really appreciate that because most of the companies are dying, especially in the country. And, you know, in the beginning of your presentation, Ms. Mbili, when you talked about electronic distribution, and I was sitting here asking myself about companies in Tabantu, in my constituency, and some of the people are really not computer literate. Some of them are actually illiterate. You know, they just know that this is my company, this is how I've been doing it and all that. So when you talk of electronic documents and all that, I'm asking myself about those companies. Are we talking about some companies like SAP, you know, these big companies? Or are we including all companies? Because in your definition, you actually said all companies that are there. And you actually went further to be talking about non-profit organizations and the profit organizations and all that. So, what you're talking about is actually this big company. But have you considered the small companies? Chairperson, again on site A. Commission must register company even if chosen name is unavailable by signing registration number as interim name of the company. You know, it was difficult because as we are presenting, I was trying to go through the six document just to say no and to make sense of what we are doing through the six document. So that's why some of the things I've said in my notes, can you explain them further? And when you talk about the reckless trading, do you have a description in the document, description of reckless trading? Because some of the things that you have said are actually good, but when you say to somebody, what are the reasonable, give me reasonable, second what do you say about reasonable? But when you say this is a reasonable, what is reasonable or unreasonable and all that, is it clearly defined here? Because it becomes difficult. I can say this is reasonable to me, but we find that in the other part it's going to be unreasonable. So it's a question and I'll ask one question.
Thank you, Comrade Amino. Comrade Farida, who's your next?
Thank you, Comrade Chair. When she asked about the Ombudsman, I looked at the book, it said it has jurisdiction throughout the Republic. I need to know, the access to an Ombudsman is difficult normally. Creditors, shareholders, and directors can actually go to an Ombudsman. And normally, there is also a problem with regard to consumers that actually don't even know about the existence of such a structure. So I need to know, is there any way that we could look at perhaps advocacy in this regard? Because the role of an ombudsman is a very important role. Because when there is discontent and some kind of pressure of wrongdoing in the company, and it affects the creditors and the shareholders, or vice versa, they don't have a choice to operate them. I know in terms of consumers, there is a consumer, place where they can go. But I just want us to look at that, perhaps. I just want to know, in terms of, when a person wants to buy a company, mergers or even acquisitions, there is a problem with regard to buying a company without knowledge of liabilities. details of that company. As actually in my constituency, I had many reports where people have bought companies and then they realize that there are liabilities. But that could be obviously a default on either side because they did not check out what was the liability. But I want to know how do you safeguard these kinds of activities. And also there are companies where the shares being bought by shareholders. But there is no provision for these shareholders to sell these shares to the same company.
Mm.
And somehow people that bought the shares didn't know that until they wanted to sell the shares back to the company. And the company then says, no, you can't sell these shares back to us. You bought these shares, it's your shares now. You can do whatever you want. But what about the shareholder that might require that money to reinvest into something else because that's not proper?
Thank you.
So that's another issue that might want some clarity. I think creditors normally don't have knowledge of companies amalgamating. Sorry, I don't know. And I'm just having a chunkless. Creditors don't have knowledge of such things. We have many, many examples such as these. You know that gym that's going down. The creditor, the users, did not even know that these companies are closed down. So the information does not filter down to the end user or to the shareholder in many cases. And does this app provide remedy? Yeah. Today I think I'm a bit tired. Battery is low. So I think one needs to look at that as well. I think I'm done. I just wanted to see board members. I wanted to look at this slide 12 because somehow I think you need to look at how you put it down. Board may finance the company through debt, through acquiring of capital finance. The word debt doesn't make sense to me. So I think that's about it. Thank you so much.
Farida, thank you. There's nothing wrong with your Duracell. Still working.
Thanks, Chair. Also, thank you for a very professional presentation. It's quite impressive. And obviously, you've done an enormous amount of work. But forgive me if I'm a little bit cynical about companies and the whole business area. There was a time when I used to read company reports in the newspapers regularly, until somebody in my family said to me, don't waste your time. These figures are so manipulated that you can't really tell what is the bottom line and what is the top line. And I've given up. So one is a bit cynical about this business of public image of companies that you're seeking to help. For example, again, you say that transparency is necessary in slide 11. You went on to say, maybe it slipped out, that you want companies to internalize transparency. I find that a little, forgive me saying, naive, because that's how manipulation happens. Transparency must be in the public domain, not internally in a company, because the interests are so strong, the temptation to not to be transparent, even to the shareholders, is so strong because profit is at stake. So, hence, transparency must be in the public domain, not in the internal domain alone. Secondly, you say the company might be financed with debt. Well, they all do it. Most companies go to the banks and say, we want to expand, so we want debt. They do it. Only our government operates with surpluses, but companies operate with debt. You know, that's the way business operates. So there are question marks about that, especially since in slide 13 you say distribution can be made with upon approval of the board, but without shareholder approval. Without shareholder approval. Now that seems to be stretching things very, very much. The board can manipulate distribution without the protection of shareholders. I'd love your comment on that, because it seems to me, I don't know if this is new in law or not, but it seems to me a very important principle that shareholder approval of distribution is fundamental in a company, I would have thought. The director's standard of conduct. Now, you know, I'd like to hear whether your bill is in compliance with King and that sort of ethos. King has gone to a great deal of trouble to sit down values and morality, ethics, and all that. I find that in your presentation that was a bit lacking. And for me, that's the starting point. I mean, this is Parliament. We're not a technical body here of lawyers and accountants looking at the full stops and commas. We have to see whether the legislation that we are passing as Parliament is in accordance with the national ethos and values. That's our primary duty. So I found that a little bit lacking in your presentation. And may I ask whether my two impressions are correct? The first impression is that this bill frees up companies far more than is the present situation in order to attract foreign investors, to be compliant with international practices and so on. My impression is that you're actually freeing up companies and that for me could be a problem. Do we really want to free up corporate performance in South Africa beyond public control and judgment? That's my one question. Secondly, your emphasis, if I understand you rightly, on minorities within companies. Now, we are faced with a situation where the corporate world is controlled by a minority of the country. The PIC is trying to do something to change that. So the PIC, as a minority shareholder in many big companies, goes through these meetings and makes a lot of noise about BEE and all that. And are you saying, it's a question, are you saying that the PIC as a minority shareholder in a large company will not have the same powers under this bill as they do at the moment? Because I would have thought, if we're going to transform South Africa, South Africa's corporate world, and this is the object of our parliament, then the PIC representing the public interest, as opposed to individual company interest, that the PIC should have more powers as a minority shareholder rather than less. Otherwise, transformation will not happen. So that's my last question. And then just a short request, Chair. You know, we're discussing the whole corporate world of South Africa here. It would be very nice if the department could come and give us a picture of this corporate world. Who is there? How big is it? How does it compare with other countries? You know, Brazil, India, etc. Are we talking about a minor thing and so on? I know I'm asking a lot, and maybe the department doesn't have the capacity to do it. But it would be very nice if the department would maybe outsource to some academics or somebody to do a nice profile for this committee and say, the company's bill refers to this elephant here, and give us a picture of its size, of its capital, all that stuff. I think it would be very helpful for us so we know what we're talking about. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, sir, Professor Chiro. When you said the company's bill is referring to this elephant, I saw Danny looking.
I'm very concerned,
Chair. Definitely not the elephant.
He is in the preservation of animals.
Good folks.
Sorry.
I would like us to have
I have forgotten you,
Mr. Yes. Officer. Okay, please have your question.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks to the presenters. Electronically filing, which I think that's I have no problems with that because you can either do electronic documents or the hard copies. I'm just always worried, not being very technically minded, when I think of, you know, a hard copy you might get hold, you can still get hold of a 500-year-old document, piece of paper that you hold. And when I think, well, you know, systems, I don't know if it's really applicable here, but in 80, 90 years' time, or even less, will I be able to access the stuff on my computer today? You know, systems change. We've gone through floppy, stiffies, now everything's digital. I just hope somehow somebody's going to keep, you know, documents that are very old and we'll still be able to get hold of them. I mean, if I wanted to play my old 33, and that dates me, RPM vinyl records, I couldn't get. I mean, a new cars today, you can't even play a cassette in because they. Like, so that worries me a bit about the loss of data. On slide 8, you talk about reckless trading will be an offence. We don't define reckless, I see, in the bill. I'd be curious, is that what is reckless trading? When you say you're registering on slide 10, a name must be provided accurately on request. Shouldn't it be obligatory that companies provide their name and registration number? And I suppose also when you say you register, even though the name is not free, would they just then, I assume they're just going to trade under the number. Now, some aspiring entrepreneur wants to register his company as Pick and Pay. You give him a number, but he can trade on the number, but not on the Pick and Pay. Am I correct on page slide 11 that there will be a much simpler provision for smaller companies with regard to financials? You know, I've had a case or two where you have a small, what is the right, sectional titles, they all have to be a company. And often the auditing fees, the strict auditing fees are almost 50% of their levy income. Is that being, you know, is there relaxation for this type of situation? I get the impression, but if you could just clarify that. Powers of the board. I realize that one allows one's efficiency and flexibility and directors and so forth. But, you know, all big disasters, to my knowledge, stem from directors and the action. And the poor shareholders are left in the dark, or in the dock. So this worries me about vacant increase and decrease in asset. You know, I mean, they award themselves shares, they change shares, and, you know, where do the shareholders, who are actually the owners of the company, the directors, are employees, in a certain sense. That worries me a bit. Almost finished. And then you mentioned just interestingly that chapter 6 was relatively unchanged, if I understood you, from the current, because of the large volume of case law, which is. Was there no thought to rewrite the chapter incorporating all the volume of case law, or is it easier to leave it? Just an aside. And I would assume on the close corporations that conversion, will it be simple? Do you just write and would you just go through the simplified country, you know, company's procedure, or can you just write an letter and say, books, we want to change. Yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Mr. Alcatin, the cheapest watch in the room says it's 11. I'd like us to take a 15-minute break for tea. Left is that much colder than it is right now. And then the audit break and everybody wakes up again. qualify the name.
I think it would be propitious at this point to take a rejoinder from the department to the comments and questions, issues raised by members. And thereafter, we'll take another turn of questions and comments. Thank you, good folks.
Thank you, Chair. And thanks, members, for the questions. The team here is going to attend to the questions, and I'll come in at the end just to maybe clarify certain things that may not have been covered. We'll start with Tepo, and then the other members of the team will then come in there. Thanks.
Thank you, honourable members and stakeholders. We have identified the questions, and we have also allocated the people who will be responsible for responding to the questions. I would like to start by responding to the question that was posed in connection with the definition of hostile takeovers, mandatory offers, and squeeze-out provisions as to what the differences are between those transactions. A hostile takeover is not necessarily defined in terms of the act, but as the consequences of what happens as a result of a takeover that will actually lead to the imposition of the requirements of the bill. Let's take for an example, if a person would like to acquire shares in a company and is coming up with the price which is attractive to the shareholders, but definitely the management or the board of the directors is against the person acquiring the securities from the current shareholders within the company. That we call a hostile takeover, because we are approaching the people who are holding the shares in that particular company, and we would like to take control over that particular company by means of securities or shares in that company. You are actually proposing a hostile takeover because the management is not in favor of it. Now, what happens is if you happen to gain one share as a result of your offer, nothing really would happen. But if you then acquire, let's say, in a regulated company, a public company, you acquire shares in excess of 5%, then the provisions of the takeover regulations and the provisions of late the notice been given to the company and the takeover regulation panel then kick in. If you then go over 35%, then the provisions relating to mandatory offer will then kick in, which say that you have to then give notice to all the remaining shareholders that you have already reached the threshold of 35%, therefore you would like to acquire all the remaining shares. And if they give you their shares at the price that you are offering them, and you reach 90%, then you are in a squeeze-out domain, where then the law allows you to give notice to the remaining 10% of the shareholders that you would like to acquire their securities, and they are obliged to render them to you at a price that you have already given to the people who had previously accepted your offer up to 90%. That is how the progression of it. Hostile just means that it's not supported really by the board of the directors. And when you reach particular thresholds, then depending on the nature of the company, then certain requirements then kick in. If you reach 10% in a private company that is not a regulated company, you really don't, the regulation of the takeover regulation panel doesn't kick in. But obviously, if you are going to propose the 5 or 10% in a company that is a regulated company, then those provisions come in the sense that you need to give notice to the company, you need to give notice to the takeover regulation panel, and comply with all the requirements of the takeover regulation panel. And as you go by 35 and 90, that is how it is. Now, it is not hostile, obviously, when there is an agreement and probably there's a merger as a result. Let's say your company is the one that wanted to acquire the shares in company B. Company A is your company that wanted to acquire the shares in company B. and company B agrees that no, it's fine, we will sell, or we will amalgamate the two companies, or we will come up with a scheme of arrangement. Under such circumstances, it's no longer worth that, because the management is on board with regard to the proposal. Thank you. The other question that I need to respond to is in relation to business rights. A question was posed as to how do you detect whether a company is in financial distress, because we have already said that the legislation has now moved from an insolvency event to a company being in financial distress. We held a conference where the stakeholders in the area of business administration and business rights were invited to the DTI. And one of the main concerns that they raised was that in the way that the legislation was couched at the time when it was approved by cabinet, it basically referred to an insolvency event, or the emphasis was based on an insolvency event. And the worry was that by the time that it comes to being insolvent, basically the company, it is too late to save that particular company. It's well down the drain, such that you cannot be able to save it. And it was proposed, which we actually agreed with and drafted the definition of financial distress, to say that a company is in financial distress if there is a likelihood that that particular company will be unable to pay its debts as they fall due in the ordinary course of business within a period of 6 months from the time that the determination is made, or if its assets are likely to be exceeded by its liabilities tremendously within 6 months from the time of the determination, such that the company will basically become insolvent. And therefore, under such circumstances, you will be able to then enter into business rescue. Remember that a business rescue can be entered into basically in two main ways. Firstly, by the company passing a resolution of the board of the directors or the shareholders that the company needs to be rescued, and that could be done upon determination of the financial status of the company. For example, if the company was relying on a very major supplier who was giving them a contract, which actually was a lifeline of that particular company, and due to disagreement maybe with the company policy or what have you, he decides that he's no longer going to continue to offer that contract to the company in the next 2 months when it is due when it is due for renewal. Now the company may say, once this contract is gone, this company is basically not going to make it. And therefore, under these circumstances, we think that we would be basically insolvent in a period of less than 6 months from now. And therefore, we therefore want to pass a resolution to the effect that we would like to enter into business rescue. And the effect of the business rescue is that it brings about the moratorium that the debt that it owes to third-party creditors cannot be enforced during the time of the business rescue, so that it gives them a breathing space within which they can be able to restructure their business so that they can be a viable concern because of that moratorium that is given for the period of the business rescue. Therefore, it is important because you are able to even detect the problem that may be coming in a period of 6 months from the time that you make a determination, and therefore you will be able to then avoid that. And it's in two ways, in relation to the balance sheet solvency and in relation to equity solvency. Balance sheet solvency relates to the liabilities of the company exceeding the assets of the company, and in relation to equity solvency, we're speaking about the company not being able to pay its debt as they fall to in the ordinary course of business because of some contract or whatever cash flow problems that are envisaged in the future. The question was posed in cabinet relation to whether this would have avoided situations like nationwide airlines, which had a cash flow problem and therefore had to stop operating. I mean, that is a classic example under which a company could be, or the financial status of the company could be determined well in advance for the company to go into business rescue before things get out of control, when people lose their jobs, people lose their livelihoods and everything.
coming in, and I will attempt to answer some of the more practical questions as posed by the members. The one question was dealing with the capacity of the commission and what thought has gone into the particular process. The department at present is dealing with drafting a business case in order to identify the various functions of the regulatory agency of the commission and to cluster them in such a way that they're capacitized. The capacity given to us at present in terms of warm bodies is 580 for the company and intellectual property commission. It also encompasses the education and awareness, the registration function, the enforcement function, which is and the supporting function. But one needs to look at also the other aspects in terms of capacity of the commission. Of course, at present, the company's intellectual property registration of the CIPCO, as you know, is also dealing with certain partnerships that encompass an increase of the awareness and the footprint of the department. At present, we know that we have a centralized office in Pretoria, but we're looking at decentralizing. We should also add capacity in that sense. We're looking at building partnerships with the African Post Office, with other regulatory agencies in the DTI family, as well as local government. For example, we'll be having a workshop in the next couple of days with multiple purpose centers throughout South Africa, and they will also be involved in providing advice on registration as well as the registration function itself. One also needs to look at the impact that e-technology will have on the capacity, because e-opinions will be anticipated by certain aspects of the vote, but it has been put into the current company, as you know. So we need to look at the impact that will have in the access into the system as well. That also adds capacity to the organization to deal with the functions that the membership and task the members to do. One of the other questions, which was how long does name reservations take? The current turnaround time for name reservations is less than a day. We can make an application today in a few hours, and we're able to have a turnaround time in terms of that. So in terms of the overall turnaround time currently within the department, in terms of the registration of close corporations, for example, we're looking at a maximum of 2 days. For a normal private company, you're looking at a maximum between 3 to 5 days. Obviously, the complexity of the company will add to it. If it's a public company, for example, there's more scrutinization in terms of the act and the regulation that's going into it, so it takes a lot of time. And but the majority of them are just normal processes and private companies. One of the questions posed was how many entities does the department currently have on its register? In terms of private companies, we're looking at approximately 400,000 registered private companies in South Africa. In terms of public companies, we're looking at about 4,000 public companies in South Africa. And in terms of close corporations, we're looking at approximately 1.6 million CC close corporations. I want you to put it into context as well. The department is currently in the process of fully rolling out something called an annual return, which regulates companies in terms of the supply of information on an annual basis to ensure that they are alive and surviving and that they are functioning. We rolled out in a phased approach. The first was public companies, which we had approximately 8,500 on the register. After it has been rolled out in front of the annual return process, we overseen an halving of that particular number. So from 8,500, we're looking at about 4,000 active public companies in South Africa over a period of time. Second phase was the rollout of private company, which had just occurred, which, as I stated, is approximately 400,000 in the register. We're looking at probably removing more than 40% of those as well. So we have a defined register of all active private companies that are in South Africa. So I look at about maybe 200,000 in South Africa. Close corporations is a large chunk. Close corporations is legal registration, but we have numerous registrations. On a daily basis, we have anywhere between 3,000 to 5,000 on the register. We're looking at almost halving of that. Active, I would say about 700,000 active. So that should give you a defined figure of what is the actual corporate activity in terms of policy in the South African corporate landscape. Maybe just to answer one of the other questions as opposed to
your mic.
Sorry, just to answer one of the other questions posed by one of the honourable members in terms of the drive towards e-commerce and e-technology and what is going to happen with all those in the far-reaching rural areas of Africa and other than but pose that question. One must bear in mind that e-technology and e-access is only an alternative to the normal system of manual access. It's not a complete drive. If you have the capabilities within your organization and your business to use that particular portal of entry and parking, then we give you the alternative to use that. But we still continue with the manual. Well, as we define it as a hybrid system, we have the e-technology and we have the manual technology, about the manual permission. As I mentioned in the earlier comments, is that there's a big drive now to decentralize the office. And one of the biggest footprints that we have, and we're entering into partnership, I, for example, was in a meeting this week with the South African Post Office, which is the largest portal into South African administration, is that we're partnering with them, and there's some 2,700 post offices. We find them all over the place. So that will also be ease of access, because the Commission's role in terms of awareness and education will also filter down into the partnerships in which we envisage, because we mean educating those partners to deal with the registrations and the registration entities that come through those particular portals. So if a person walks into the post office in Karagua, then that particular post office will be trained, and the personnel will be trained in terms of registration for them to have either access to that particular registration.
Just to carry on where I left off, there was a question relating to dissemination of reckless trading, that one of the slides refers to offense trading under reckless circumstances, and that since there is no such definition in the bill, how is it determined? Reckless trading is, or recklessness is a common law term which has been defined in many of the cases that I decided, particularly in relation to our Food Corporations Act, where the fraudulent mind of the person responsible for an action is actually investigated, and therefore if any fraudulent intent is found, then that particular person will be regarded as having traded under reckless circumstances. If you look at Section 65 of the current Food Corporations Act, which deals with reckless trading and the use of a closed corporation name in order to defraud creditors, you will find that there are decided cases there that basically define what reckless trading is. And we did not find it particularly difficult that it should be defined or given a definition into the bill, as it is a well-known term and the courts know how to deal with it. And even with the permission, as it will be, as it is envisaged for enforcement of this legislation, it would have access to such information and therefore would know how to determine it. And for that matter, the company, the commission is given the power to be able to assess all the information that is given to the commission, including the financial statement. And it is able to detect in terms of the operations of any particular company, whether the company is trading under reckless or is trading under insolvent circumstances. And under such circumstances, the company may find itself to be have committed an offense, and even the people who are responsible for running the company may find themselves to be running a risk of criminal liability. The buying of company shares in situations where companies have got liabilities, there was a question as to how do you then, know that the company has got liabilities. I think since all the companies will be required to have to keep the financial records, and at any rate, certain companies, almost all companies will be required to have annual financial statements in a plain language that is envisaged in terms of the bill, before a person can be able to buy a share in a company, they should determine the financial status of that particular company. And it will be easy with the provisions of the bill that are currently proposed for the purposes of determining the financial status of that particular company. And therefore, it will actually determine the decision whether to buy or not to buy. And a related question which was asked was whether a person can be able to then take the shares back to the company for the company to buy them. There is no such provision under corporate legislation, neither is there any such provision under corporate legislation that we looked at. The buyback provision is instigated only when the company has decided that it is in the best interest of the company to buy back some of the shares that it has issued. And under such circumstances, the company may decide, in line with the provisions of the bills or of the act, to buy back the shares. But you cannot just go back and knock on the door of the company and say, I bought my shares, but I want you to buy them from me. Now, depending on what the memorandum of incorporation or the constitution of the company says, if there is a restriction on the transferability of the shares, it means that you will have to approach the people whom, in terms of the constitution, you have to approach the records of selling those shares to. And if they do not agree to buy those shares from you, then if the memorandum allows you to then sell them generally to the public, then you can be able to sell those shares to the public. And but usually that would be in relation to public companies. With regard to private companies, there would almost invariably be a restriction on the transferability of the securities, and you would have to sell those shares to identified individuals. And the onus is on you as a seller of those shares to get independent assessment of the value of the shares before you can be able to sell them, even to those people who are identified in the memorandum of incorporation as the people to whom you must first sell before you can approach the public. Usually, a typical provision in the memorandum of incorporation that restricts transferability of the shares will be to say, any shareholder in this particular company should, when considering to sell their shares, first sell them to or offer them for sale to the existing shareholders of the company before that particular person can offer them to any other person. That is in order to preserve the private nature of the company. But it doesn't mean that if you cannot be able to sell them to anyone within the company who is a member who is a shareholder, that means that ultimately you've got no avenue to do that to the general members of the public who may be interested in buying your shares in that particular company. But given the fact that the company is under an obligation to ensure that its first priority is towards the creditors, and then the shareholders are only given the capital as and when there is a residual value after paying the creditors, the laws of Commonwealth jurisdictions and even North American jurisdictions and other corporate laws and legislation do not, as a rule, entitle the company to buy back their shares if they cannot be able to satisfy certain requirements. Obviously, those being the solvency and liquidity test, in the sense that you are able to pay your debt as they fall to the ordinary course of business, and that your assets are exceeding your liabilities at the time when you do that. So that capital is not returned to the shareholders in a manner that is beneficial to the creditors of the company. Now, the other issue related to the slide relating to debt financing of companies by the board, the authorization of debt financing of the companies by the board. I think that was slide number 10 or 11. Let me just go back to that slide. I have to put that slide in context because I think it must have been misunderstood as to what it meant. The power of the board in relation to the security.
12.
Yes. Now, it says that since the board may finance the company through debt, and I think no one disputes that a company is able to raise any loan, whether from the bank or from any other person, for the purposes of financing its business activities. And now the argument here is that there are no restrictions in relation to and the power of the board in relation to the financing of the company through debt. And one thing that must be borne in mind is that the holders of debt instruments in the company have got more power than the holders of equity instruments. Now, a creditor of the company has got more rights than a normal shareholder in the company, in the sense that when distribution is made, the first people in line are the creditors, and then later the shareholders. Now, the argument here is that if the board is able to then is able to, without many restrictions, to finance the company through debt, why don't we give it the same powers or similar powers to be able to finance the company through equity? Because the holders of equity are actually even in less of a position than the holders of credit of debt. And therefore, that's why the provision is made here for directors to be able to deal with equity financing of the company. Obviously, we must remember that they are subject to a number of restrictions. Firstly, they are subject to a restriction in relation to the memorandum of incorporation. Usually, the memorandum of incorporation will only state under what circumstances the company may be able to do that. And the company may even restrict the board of the directors from dealing with equity financing and may give that power to the shareholders. And secondly, if it relates to the dealing of equity financing in relation to raising finance from the directors themselves or related shareholders, under certain circumstances, there must be shareholder approval. And therefore, there are certain safeguards against the abuse of this power. And if the directors do it in such a way that it will be prejudicial to other shareholders and prejudicial to the company itself, we have got standards of conduct under Section 76 and Section 77 dealing with the duty of the directors to act in the best interest of the company and to act honestly and also to act with reasonable care, skill, and diligence. And those will actually be the safeguard for the shareholders. Now, there was a provision that under every circumstance where the equity finance is proposed, there must be shareholder approval and in all circumstances. I mean, that would actually be a stumbling block to raising equity finance in a more efficient and more effective way for South African companies than it is currently done by other jurisdictions where there are modern corporate legislation. The other related issue, which I think was raised by Professor Shurov, related to the distribution without shareholder approval. And your argument was that it seems that if now the scale is tilted in favor of the board in relation to the powers that they do have. Now, we need to bear in mind that usually provisions that deal with distributions of company capital. Or currently, the share buybacks in terms of the Companies Act, which is a distribution, must be approved by the shareholders of the company. And therefore, we are saying that all distributions can be done subject to board approval. But there are safeguards that are put in place in order to protect the shareholders. One of those is the fact that if such a distribution constitutes financial assistance, then shareholder approval is required. But where it doesn't require any financing of the company, then shareholder approval is not required. But it must be subject to the terms and conditions of the memorandum of incorporation, and it must be subject always to the solvency and liquidity of the company. That means that it cannot be done if the company does not comply with the solvency and liquidity test. And thirdly, if any director authorizes a distribution in excess of that which is permitted by the law, they would find themselves to be jointly and severally liable with the company for whatever distribution that they would have made in line with the standards of conduct, that the conduct to act in the best interest of the company and also to act with reasonable care, skill, and diligence. Now, a related question relating to the director's standards of conduct, that this presentation seems to be lacking more information on the director's standards of conduct and as to the relationship between the director's standards of conduct with the provision of the Human Report. Let me say that although we did not codify the Human Report per se, as it exists in relation to director's standards of conduct, the Director's Standards of Conduct emanates from the common law, and it has also been modernized, particularly in relation to the standards of care, skill, and diligence. The director being able to act reasonably in the best interest of the company with skill, care, and diligence. And the King Report itself also extracted the common law principles that they have put in the King Report. And therefore, the process that has been followed both through by the King's report and by this provision in relation to the standards of conduct is the same. By this bill in relation to standards of conduct is the same. The consideration of a statement of duty that is found at common law. And what has happened is the King's report, particularly in relation to the study of the duty of care, skill, and diligence, did not go as far as what the bill has done by providing for an objective standard or a combination of an objective and subjective standard. The King's report seems to be proposing a subjective standard, which has been criticized in a number of quarters, has been unsatisfactory and actually not as effective as it should be in relation to the regulation of the conduct of the director. This bill is actually making the duty of care, skill, and diligence subject to both a subjective and an objective standard, in the sense that we say, would a similarly situated director in your position have done or have taken the action that you have taken in the circumstances in which you are basically found with the skill and experience that you do have? You will see that the first part of that question relates to objective standard, in the sense that we are comparing you to a similarly situated person with the same power, whether objectively he would have done what you have done as a director under the circumstances. And when we say having the same skill and experience as you, that is the subjective standard. Therefore, when you take that standard to combine it, combine the objective standard with the subjective standard, which is the international trend at the moment, that seems to be quite satisfactory, because it basically brings our law in line with modern international development and modern development, and be as effective as it should be. That is what I can say in relation to that. I think that should give my colleagues some more time to respond to that.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I'll try and give a brief answer to the questions regarding the transparency matter. The question was put that company statements and financial statements are commonly doctored, to put it in inverted commas, but that is what happens, and that the transparency should rather be in the public arena than internally within companies. What the provisions in this Act actually does is it puts it both in the public arena and it puts it back to the companies themselves. By providing legal backing for the accounting reporting standards, and by issuing these standards as regulations through the Financial Reporting Standards Council and the Minister, legal backing is given to this, so it needs to be complied with. These standards will all be based on the international reporting standards that are followed globally, but they will be adapted for South African circumstances. And so the reporting standard will become on an international level, and it would be less easy to divert from the standards in future under this dispensation. Then there's a further issue of the compliance issue in this regard. The commissioner will have to, on an annual basis, scrutinize the financial statements of the companies that are required to lodge financial statements, to determine whether proper compliance with the statements has been taking place. And the commissioner must then, in this regard, report to the standard-setting council on its findings. So the standard-setting council would be in constant contact with the reality of what's going on ground level, and through the commission. Then the other aspect is the question that the commission will have a constant duty to do research and to provide and promote education on all these matters. So the commission is going to play a much more public role than the current registrar of companies is playing. The current registrar of companies is a registering authority and really nothing more. Whereas the commission, on the other hand, will really have powers of enforcement and making sure that compliance is being done. think that will answer the issue.
Okay, I just want to deal with the last two issues and then I think we will be done. The question which was raised, I can't remember whether it's Honorable Bakhtasin who said it or whether it's Professor Akuda, in relation to the financials of the small company and as to whether there is some sort of relaxation in relation to that. We need to understand that the financial compliance in terms of this bill is as follows. All companies are required to keep financial records, and those financial records, or the content of that financial record, will be determined in line with the regulations that will be published and are currently being issued at the moment. But it's the minimal information relating to financials of the company that needs to be kept by the company. And secondly, the majority of companies must issue, must produce annual financial statements. And those will be all your companies, your public companies, your private companies, and your non-profit companies, unless the companies are exempt from producing annual financial statements. Now, what are those companies that are exempt from producing annual financial statements? They are those companies that are referred to as personal liability companies, firstly. That means those companies whose directors or whose shareholders are also the directors of the company and are referred to as professional companies. And in the sense that the directors are also jointly and severally liable for the debts of the company. Under such circumstances, we didn't find any interest that we have to protect in relation to the issue of financial statements, particularly because the information will be well known to the people who are running that particular company. And at any rate, there is a joint and several liability provision in relation to the shareholders who are also the directors of the company anyway. Secondly, the private companies where the only shareholder, there is only one or related shareholders within the particular company. That means that where it's only, it's a mom and pop general dealer at the corner and is registered as a company. Under such circumstances, a company is so small that that particular company should not be burdened with the requirement of producing annual financial statements. And thirdly, where it's a private company, but it's not necessarily a personal liability company, but the holders of securities of that company are also the directors of the company, and they therefore have access to financial information. You don't need to have any produce annual financial statement of that company. And the relationship between that exemption and the exemption for auditors is the same. Those companies that are not exempted from producing annual financial statements must actually have their statements audited if they are public or state-owned companies or other private companies, as and when determined by the commissioners that they must be, have their statements audited. And secondly, independently reviewed if they are not public companies or state-owned enterprises or private companies that have been identified by the commissioner to have their statements audited. Now, independent review is something less of an audit, but it involves the assurance that the information that has been provided is basically in line with the financial records that the company does have, so that it gives a clear picture of the financial situation of the company. That is actually applicable across the board, except for those companies that are exempt from producing annual financial statements. Therefore, audits are basically, they are companies that are exempted from an audit, so that you don't impose a cost upon a company that does not actually benefit from such a cost, and there is no benefit even to any other stakeholder for imposing such a cost upon the company. Now, the last question related to Chapter 6. I think the question said that I made a statement that the chapter, not much has been changed in relation to the chapter, because it is basically, there's a lot of case law that has been decided in relation to that chapter, and the issue is whether we have tried to expatiate on the case law or we have just reenacted the law as it is. Now, we need to remember that the chapter is basically divided into two separate components, if we are to call it that way. The business rescue proper, that relates to the process of getting into business rescue and the approval and the appointment of supervisors and the sale of whatever assets that are there, and to bring the company back into its viability. And the process of compromise, which is in part E of chapter 6. I said that compromise was previously part and parcel of section 311, or is currently part of section 311 under the 1973 Act, which is the scheme of arrangement. And in the bill, we have divorced the scheme of arrangement from a compromise. But we had earlier not included a compromise in the bill at all. And now we made it part and parcel of chapter 6 as part E. Now we have, to a large extent, tried to provide the essence of the decisions that have been taken over the years in relation to compromises in that particular chapter. It is not just verbatim reproduction of the current section 211, so that we reflect the developments that have taken place in relation to the compromises. But we thought it's a very important tool as well. If a business rescue cannot be adhered to, or business rescue cannot be instituted, then there must be another method of trying to save a business, and that could be through a compromise. Thank you.
I'm not going to add anything. I think the team has responded to all the questions. But I just want to just remind the members that when we prepared the presentation, we moved from the perspective that some of the information, like background information, like statistics, were already provided. But if it's required, I think we'll be happy to provide that information again next time when we come here, or we can even forward it to the committee secretariat, and so that you can have it just for future reference. Thanks.
The issue with members is that we get different presentations every other day of the week. So by the time you have all the documents, it's very difficult to remember exactly where and when you keep what. But they do give the documents requisite attention. But it does help when you come to make presentations, just to give a background. It's better to err on the side of caution. Thanks. Another round of questions, members, or comments. Rob Turok was first, and then I think the end of the Congress speaker. Mr. Lamshaki, is your hand up?
Yeah, all right.
Then
I just want to actually clarify my understanding of my previous question.
Okay, shall we start with yours then? Then I'll go back to Prof. Chiron. Mr. Lamskat,
Nita? Yeah. Now, it wasn't to avoid financial statements. It is sometimes you have a small company, I'll take example, a small complex, section 31, and the financial statement of affairs, that sometimes the cost of the CA, the auditor, the accountant, the chartered accountant, is about a third of what, eats into everything which lays the burden. And I'm just wondering if there's provision when you have a small security that you can get, you get accountants, you get the CA, the big companies. Isn't there some provision for, a bookkeeper or something to prepare the state? Now they've got to go and spend R3,000 or R4,000. It's a four-line, one-page financial statement. In order to come, these guys don't come cheap. That's really what I was getting at for this type of situation. Not doing away with financials, but maybe doing away sometimes with the, the fact that couldn't somebody, isn't there? There are other bodies that are not auditors, CA auditors, that could do the books. That's basically what I'm getting at.
Yeah, just to quickly deal with this now. Basically, since the bill does not propose that every company must have a dedicated accounting officer or an auditor. That means that a company is free to use the services of any person to prepare their financial statements. It doesn't have to be a head of accountant. It doesn't have to be an auditor. Therefore, any person can actually prepare their financials. But if the company is under obligation to have such statements independently reviewed, that particular person also will not be necessarily an auditor. But therefore, it can be someone else who probably would belong to another professional organization.
Yeah. Okay.
It's only when you are required to have an audit, then that your statement will have to be audited by an auditor.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Prof.
Chair, I just want to emphasize that my point of departure is the public interest. We need efficient companies, we need investment, and so on. But you know, when you look at the subprime crisis in the United States, when you look at the WorldCom collapse, the whole bubble that America has seen over the last few years, it's not only bad performance by companies that we're interested in, although that's very important, but the impact on the public interest. And that's my point of departure. Now, take, for example, the question of the expert. You're going to have an autonomous or independent expert and so on, paid by the company. Now, we know from the Finance Committee of this Parliament that when a company pays an auditor, and it's a big company and the contract is huge, that auditor is going to comply with some of the requests of the company. So independent is a very relative term in this game. Now, you want to appoint a so-called independent expert who is paid by the company, and I would argue that person will not be independent. Where does the public interest come in? If I have shares in a company, and they employ an expert who's going to be manipulated because he's paid by the board, what is the protection for me? What's the protection for society, for the employment structure of that company? It's not good enough. So, take the other question of options. The biggest racket in companies these days, and I use that word advisedly, is options. We, WorldCom and those companies, I forget the other name, what they did was they gave their directors options. The options were back priced to when the prices were low. When the prices are realized and the company is on the verge of collapse, the prices are high, they offload. Salaries are negligible compared to the tens of millions of US dollars that these guys, and the same applies here, tens of millions of rand that directors make through options. Now, you know, this bill is largely structured, rightly, to ensure efficiency and compliance by companies. But where does it protect the public interest? And I fear that there is not enough here to say that the shareholder and even the indirect customer consumer, the public, is not adequately protected unless we introduce measures which directly impact on things like options, experts who are paid by the company. I would like us to use, imagine, I'm not in the game, so I can't come with solutions. But it seems to me, yeah, well, I'm not, I confess, I'm only an MP, so and not a financial guru anyway, not a company expert anyway. So, why can't we introduce some loop which protects the public so that the experts are in some way reporting to the public, so that the share options, the way options are established or also in the public domain. I would like us to have some loop, an external loop. This bill, in my view, is too internalized. And even if I may say, you use the word internal, what, something or other, I immediately reacted. Internal. That's exactly our problem. If you look at the annual statements, I mean, you keep telling us they're going to be annual statements. Those annual statements are fiddled. What is the bottom line in a public company which you see in the Cape Times or Business Day? What does it mean? They declare their annual profit. It doesn't mean much because the figures are fiddled. They are adjusted. I know because my family tell me that this is what happened. So I've got inside information. I'm an insider. Thank you.
Procuror, you are an outsider looking in.
Don't talk about the tension.
Thanks, Jeff.
The microphones have gone on strike.
Oh, okay. The 10 years have only moved out.
No, quite right. Let me also express my appreciation of the group that is very well, truly in their selling work. We've come a long way, but obviously I hope they'll appreciate really. At times become information drunk, you know. I've been trying to rack my mind for this Ledamungalo remembers. I even paid a visit in one of the workshops, but you can imagine back up between that time and now. The first area I'd like to just try the people rehashing is the shareholder director relations. We may have articulated it one way or another, but there are certain things that come up, including what Professor Roger raised, you know. Probably just to say where and how they are articulated, because they become fundamental. The basis is that there are a couple of issues that have been introduced whereby directors now or the board of directors can do things not necessarily, you know, referring to shareholders practically. That's what triggered my mind. A small one around the scheme of arrangement. It seems to be a significant introduction. Just a small question. Is there no need of defining it? Because I was, as you were talking, you know, I was looking at it, even trying to look at this document as well. I have to feel that the way it's presented, articulated it properly, that what the scheme of arrangement is. I pose that question because I know and acknowledge the significance of the introduction of the scheme of arrangement and the distinction with what is included in Chapter 5 and also Chapter 6. When it comes to the forthcoming commission as convention control, it just occurred in my mind that what does it mean now? Will the we are dealing with companies, but also there is the other aspects of cooperatives. My understanding that cooperatives will be dealt with under the Cooperatives Act, and the commission will not necessarily be just confined to the companies. That's what one wanted to see if there's a distinction in that. Also, one of the things the commission will do is to coordinate with other agencies. For example, which ones and how as well. Around the company's ombuds, apparently it's supposed to intimately and intensively interact with the forthcoming commission. Will its relation be analogous or similar to that of the current Competition Commission and the tribunal? Just to try and pick up an understanding. Maybe the same effect not true. Another, just general comment there. You know, as I was listening to the issue of hostile takeover, just to reinforce Professor Turok's input, history has shown that hostile takeovers at times are not just because the management is not interested and shareholders are interested. At times, the South people that have the intention to kill competition. If they can just comment on that. And I had mentioned of need of a squeeze out domain as well at 90%.
And also, in terms of transparency, would we see the institutions like SARS playing a role in enhancing transparency? Because it's obviously, you know, what I see is that one of the areas that is being introduced is to arrange an early warning system rather than to cover a compound which is definitely bad, often solvency. The bill seems to be trying to ensure that, you know, ahead of time we can actually pick up, you know, signs of financial distress as it is being, you know, indicated. The last one, Chair, a little bit general and outside, but I strongly believe it's linked. And one of the issues that our negotiators in the Doha round they were complaining about is the introduction of new generation issues, and amongst them is the role of investment. I just wanted to pick up from the presenters whether if they've taken, if they picked up those issues, whether they wouldn't affect the Commonwealth Act as or the bill as it is being revised. Thanks.
Could I just add something to Professor Turok's comment? And coming back to the board of directors, I did raise it maybe not as a particular thing. And I take your explanation that if the board can present, you know, but this also then worries me that the board issue shares to themselves. Not. Operated only so two options.
Without
shareholders' consent.
It must be with the shareholders' consent.
Thank you. That is the option.
Yeah, even including the option.
Have you said?
Thank you, Chair. Mine is just a small issue. It's about, again, the earlier question that we both asked the capacity and the figures that we got of 550. And you look at all the responsibilities that are going to have. So I'm just asking myself questions, and I think it's going to be difficult. You know, with the credit example, I remember in my constituency, when somebody had a problem and we phoned a national regulator, they didn't know how to respond to that. And meanwhile, it was something that was passed, and they came to the committee and assured us that they would be able to deal with it. And it was difficult. I mean, the person asked a question to the minister referred it to the regulator, and they couldn't answer that. So when you look at the number of companies that they talk about, it's roughly maybe 1.5, you know, including the CC, the public companies and all that. So you ask yourself, is 580 enough to deal with those? And when they talk about financial statements and reports and all that, it's important that each and every company has that. But who is going to overlook? Who's going to check if this is happening? Or is it something that we are going to pass as parliament, and after that it's not going to be implemented down there? And you think of, you know, there are sort of lots of, in each and every town, for instance, there's this small company that I send in self company, where you talk about 1.4 million. Did you include those companies as well? And you know, when you go there and you want a company, it takes you 2 hours to get a company to have money. Is there anything that is time, because obviously the cost is a little bit higher and all that. In the whole act or the bill, do you have anything that regulates those self companies, you know, those companies that are self companies? And the commissioner, that we are taking, just for interest, is the commissioner already employed? Are we still going to advertise?
Thank you. Honourable Member Gulu is obviously speaking to the issues of regulation and the enforcement of compliance. So if you can say a word in regard to that, the broad framework. Good folks from the department, it's your chance to yet again earn your living.
Yet again, for your permission, the team will deal with those, and I'll respond to the issue that you just raised.
Are all the mics dead? Just try and see if there's anyone that's not gone on strike.
Is it not somewhere?
This has got nothing to do with load shedding.
Chairperson, I just want to quickly respond to the question relating to the regulation of shell companies, which I think is quite important. The reason why shell companies thrived in the environment of the 1973 Act and the 1969 Close Corporations Act was because it was taking too long for companies and close corporations to be registered. And with this bill, the way the process has been facilitated, and the fact that you could be able to register a company in a matter of hours when this company comes into place, the role of shell companies is really going to be rendered almost in obsolete. Because you must remember that when you buy a shell company, you still have to make amendments. You still have to make amendments to the directors. You still have to make amendments to any other thing that the new shareholder would prefer in their company than what is currently on the shelf. And therefore, with the doing away of the mandatory name reservation, with the doing away with the need for an accounting officer's letter or any letter of the accountant in relation to other private companies, then the process of registration is going to be done in a matter of hours. And as a result, shell companies are still going to be a thing of the past. And yeah, an issue that could be related maybe to shell companies is the name reservation, which is transferable. Now, you must remember that a person can register a name and that name can be transferable. Certain people may approach that in a way of buying names or securing names for the purposes of selling them, so that when you go and check on the database to find that the name is available, you find that it's already taken, whereas those people are actually making business out of it. Now, there are provisions in the bill that regulate name squatting or name abuse. And if the commissioner or the commission is of the view that a name reservation is done particularly for the purposes of squatting in a name or abusing the name reservation system, then that particular person or organization may be barred from using the name reservation system.
Just to come into the aspect of the commissioner, whether it's been identified, in terms of the decision arrangement in the bill, the CEO of Companies Intellectual Property Registration Office automatically becomes the commissioner of the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission. To answer that one, does the bill take into account cooperatives? Yes, if you look at Schedule 6, also list all the legislation in which the commission shall be and the cooperative act, you will see
includes in terms of that. So the commission will be involved in the registration of cooperatives as well as the enforcement and the regulation of cooperatives as well. So let's on to another aspect in terms of regulation and the relationship between SARS and the transparency, the early warning system. There is actually a big drive at the moment in order to see a cross-linking of databases between certain regulatory agencies. It came very much from the prevention debacle, and we're all quite familiar with that. National Treasury on their own has embarked on something called a regulation forum, where they recruit the majority of regulations in the South African corporate landscape in order to look at how they can link between the databases between themselves, as well as to have regular meetings, as well as looking at amending the pieces of legislation to enforce cross-linkages between the various regulations. There's also a big drive for SARS at the moment in terms of process which has started, which is called the Integrated Business Register, which would basically mean that there will also be a free flow of movements of information between between various regulators, for example, SARS, Department of Labor, Department of Trade and Industry, and as well as the Commission. And SET, if they will also keep as a watchdog to see what type of information is utilized between the customer databases. This will also entail, obviously, an early warning system if, for example, annual financial statements are available through various regulators in the corporate landscape in terms of that particular project which starts to come in at the moment.
And this will also facilitate the registration of businesses, since the many of the regulatory agencies will also act as entry points for registration of businesses as well. And since the intention of that project that he talked about, Integrated Business Register, is to have a same or single entry point, the registration numbers for the purposes, for different purposes, will be the same. Therefore, companies will have what I prefer to call an ID number, which will be used for all the purposes, for tax purposes, for company purposes, and for labor law purposes, and all this kind of thing. Therefore, there wouldn't be a number or a myriad of different numbers that the company has for different purposes in relation to which regulatory agencies they report to. I just thought I should deal with the issue of the relationship between shareholders and directors. I think the view or the impression that I'm getting is that honorable members seem to believe or to think that the bill is actually tilting the balance in favor of the directors as opposed to the shareholders. I must say that the bill still recognizes that certain decisions of the company cannot be taken by the board of the directors without shareholder approval. And if you look at the current Part F of Chapter 2, dealing with corporate governance, it identifies situations under which a company will need the company shareholders to approve transactions before they can be implemented by the company. And at any rate, the memorandum of incorporation can be amended at any time by the special resolution of the shareholders to fit the needs of the shareholders if they think that the powers of the directors have been tilted too much into the directors. And be that as it may, we think that the process of allowing the directors to have certain powers is actually up to individual companies. That certain companies may actually restrict certain powers in terms of their memorandum of incorporation as it is required, and that they can be able to do so. And therefore, it is not up to the directors to always call the short source effect in relation to any transaction. And generally, some of the decisions cannot be taken by the directors if the solvency and liquidity test cannot be satisfied. And then those are the majority of the transactions. And the solvency and liquidity test's main purpose is to protect not only the shareholders but also the creditors of the company and to ensure the financial viability of the company on the long term. And therefore, to a large extent, the bill tries to balance both the interests of the shareholders and the interests of the directors. Yeah, the last issue which I would like to deal with is in relation to how is the public interest protected in all of that. Now, I think one thing that we must bear in mind is that with the introduction of the regulatory framework that is proposed in the bill, of the company commission, of the ombuds, of the court and everything, you know, the bouquet of all those enforcement mechanisms, you would find that any enforcement or any provision that can be enforced by any person, either be the shareholder or the member of the public or any interested stakeholder, can be done in the public interest. In Chapter 7, you'll see that a local standard can actually be obtained. A local standard, the right to be able to bring up a remedy, can be enforced in the public interest rather than only in the interest of the shareholders or the interest of the company itself. And as a result, that would actually open the enforcement remedy to the members of the public generally. And that local standard does not only apply in relation to the court, it also applies in relation to enforcement of the provisions of the bill in the commission. It also applies in relation to enforcement of the provisions of the bill in the ombuds. It also applies in relation to the enforcement of the provisions of the bill in the Financial Reporting Standards Council. And as a result, that particular, if any person thinks that they are acting in the best interest of in the public interest, they can be able to approach any of the regulatory agencies on the basis of that particular provision.
I can't remember the exact. Like I said, it's going to bring about a lot of simplification, a lot of changes in the regulation of companies. But I think we need to recognize the strides that have been made so far in anticipation of this by CIPRO in particular. If you look at the turnaround time for registration of companies, that has improved significantly from where they were in a few years ago. And that's because of the advancement in technology that we're bringing in. So I think this then speaks to the issue of capacity. That when we talk about capacity that we're going to create, it's really not about the bodies that are going to be there or the heads that are going to be there, but it's really about also capacitating in terms of the technology that is required to speed up this processing of these applications and all the necessary applications that will come through to the commission. So that is something that as we're saying, that the business case is going to encompass all of that. And we appreciate that the committee is also seeing that the magnitude of the task that comes with this bill is significant. And we need to prepare for that. But Chair, moving from that, I think it speaks again to the issue of regulation and the enforcement thereof. And I think we have prepared ourselves to make sure that by the time this bill comes into place, our systems and the institutions are ready for that. And what is going to be an advantage in this particular bill is because CIPRO already exists, and we're building onto that CIPRO. So there's going to be an amalgamation of CIPRO as it exists and the enforcement division which sits within the DPI. So, and we're going to move on and then expand on that and build on that. So we're not going to start a new agency, and we're thinking that that's going to be an advantage. We're not saying that there won't be an anticipated hiccup. There may be, but we need to plan for that to make sure that we deal with it. And also we learn from some of the successes that we have as it is, and the hiccups as well. With the NCR, when the Credit Act was passed, yes, there was an influx of course, there's a whole lot of issues. But then what we were satisfied about is that we were able to deal with those issues at least immediately and attend to them. Yes, there were hiccups, but now, in fact, with every regulation that we introduce, there may be hiccups, but we want to prevent the ones that we can already foresee. We'll learn from those other agencies that we've set up and deal with those issues. And just also, Chair, it's also an issue of agency management from the part of, or a department. But when we create this agency, it's important for us to always make sure that we resource them sufficiently. But at the same time, it's also about the assessing the impact of their work. Do they do what the Act says they must do? So that's going to be an ongoing thing, and we are prepared to do that, and we're going to make those safeguards in our process, in the planning for this agency. And finally, Chair, I think the issue of public interest is a valid concern that is being raised. But I think we need to just always try and look at when we do the regulation or legislation, what is the interest, what is the primary interest that we are trying to deal with here? And in this case, it's the regulation of companies in order to reduce the burden and all of that. But we recognize that actually you find that the beneficiary of that is the consumer at the end of the day. It's the public at the end of the day. So we will create processes where the public can lodge complaints with the commission if they feel that a certain company does not operate in the manner that they comply with the Companies Act. And we can investigate that or based on the complaint. And also on a proactive basis, the commission would then do that and in an attempt to look out for the interest of the consumers. But then also recognizing that there's also complementary legislation that will then safeguard directly and specifically some of those interests of the public. Thanks, Chair, for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Any further questions, comments at this stage? I would like for us to remember that we are still going to have the formal taping. This is like brainstorming, where we flag and raise a number of issues. We are still going to get adequate time for further discussion, elaboration in regard to this, and also public hearings, so that stakeholders are able to articulate their views, so that we further enrich this process. Comrade Sisa.
Chair, and that's my question around the new generation issues coming up in W2O was not clear, but I didn't hear any response to it. I'm prepared to repeat it if it wasn't clear.
Speaking about the WTO, I'm told that there will be a ministerial conference the 31st July. very short notice, but that's the nature of the World Trade Organization. Members from the department, if you'd like to have a rejoinder in regard to the question post.
Thank you. Apologies to another member there. Tebo was just saying that maybe it would be useful to repeat the question again because we didn't get it, but we'd like to respond to it. But I would like to have an opportunity to respond to it fully if we have not, if we don't have a sufficient response for you after repeating the question.
Along the Doha round negotiations, what happened, I think it was in Singapore, EU in particular introduced a whole range of called new generation issues, which obviously the developing countries rejected. But one of them was actually rules of investment, which I think to an extent has then be either direct or indirectly linked, or may have impact, in governance or investment or acquisitions or measures. I was just checking because I know, particularly from Dr. Rob, the Minister of Deep, he hits the roof when he talks about those new generations. As I say, I'm particularly thinking out that one of the things that he wanted us to, the developing countries, to look into is rules of investment. I may be able to elaborate and take a long time out of it, but to me, I just presume that that may have some implications one way or another, because we do have foreign direct investment, we do have foreign companies locating here and being part of the various interactions, whether it's measures or amalgamations. And I suppose that amongst other things, what the EU wanted may have been to temper, sorry, I'm biased, to temper, you know, with our independence or our abilities as developing countries, you know, to you know, to prosper in our, you know, economic development or even in trade. And I'm influenced strongly by, obviously, the current trends that are happening at this stage in time. And I don't believe that the introduction of the new generation issues, particularly rural investment, could have been by any means favorable to us.
Yeah, maybe a brief answer. I know that it may not be a complete answer, but just to say that the role really of the companies bill is to basically facilitate, to regulate the incorporation of corporate entities, and also to ensure the effective enforcement of the regulation provisions of the bill without necessarily determining the investment policies of the companies themselves, and that is left basically to the companies themselves in the interest of freedom of expression and freedom of association, and also the freedom to allow people to invest in whatever that they feel they are more comfortable with. And I think insofar as government investment is concerned, that is something that may be considered, and I'm sure that the Public Enterprises Ministry is busy currently with the legislation that regulates the investment of state-owned enterprises. And insofar as companies in the private sector are concerned, this has been a movement within many of the companies that is undertaken by the companies themselves. Companies that feel that they have got a leverage in determining the policy direction of companies, they are able to set out their code of investment or code of conduct with which a company in which they are investing has to comply with. And obviously, many of those investors in South Africa and many of the developing world will not have that muscle to be able to determine to the company as to projects and strategies and everything in which the company has to invest. But where the company has a muscle to do that because of the substantial nature of the investment that it can make, under such circumstances, companies in whom they invest actually are somehow controlled, their policies are somehow controlled, and they can be able to then invest in whatever that they think is in the best interest generally of their investors and also of the public generally. But I don't think we have dealt with it under the companies bill, and it may be a matter that may need to be considered under a separate legislation because it relates to rules of investment rather than really the regulation of corporate entities per se. Thank you.
Chair, if I may, again, just to add on to what Stephen said. I think the question that's been raised is important in relation to whether when we do this legislation, we do consider what is happening internationally, either in trade discussions or whatever that may be relevant to the country as well. But, you know, like Stephen was saying, that this bill is not dealing with the investment. But I think it's important, that question is important in relation to the fact that one of the considerations, obviously, for investment in a country is how the companies are regulated or how regulation is started in that country. And that's a significant, I think, consideration for the investors. So I think that question is valid in a sense. But I think, remember that when we checked most of the benchmarks in relation to the regulations. That's what we have tried to move our company law to. We've tried to reduce the turnaround times. We've tried to reduce the burden so that, you know, investors do not feel that we are over-regulating. And that's what we balance with the fact that we still need to regulate. And again, it's important again to note, obviously, that some of the considerations or proposals that could come may not necessarily be favorable for us. But if we are able to a large extent adhere to them or at least be in line with them, it assists obviously the country in moving consistently with where the world is moving to. Although we realize that obviously it doesn't mean that if there's a consideration like that, we have to take it in and then into our own system. But this particular bill is not dealing with that. But one thing that is a good consideration, and in all the regulations that we try and do, we try and benchmark and see what is it that is best practice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, good folks. As we said at the beginning, the purpose of this exercise was to flag the important issues and to start addressing those issues. We are not able to exhaust everything today, so our following meetings will be part of this process of further elucidation and engagement in regard to a number of the issues raised here today. So it would seem that for this particular day, we have done as much as we could. Right now, I'm just left with the ANC carrying the flag of the parliament here. The opposition has left. But they did what they could, and everyone's contributions are appreciated. The delegation from the DTI department, we thank you, good folks. We look further ahead to our engagement with you, and also to the stakeholders. I'm sure as we progress down this road, there's going to be lots of interest. So we'll also be mindful to try and get more appropriate venues that will accommodate all the public interest in this particular bill and the others that we are still going to deal with. Members, thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.